And that, of course, is the indicator that it's time for me to say, turn with me, if you will, to the very beginning of chapter 40, now in the book of Bereshit, or Genesis. And I'll introduce it this way, of course. This is one of the, probably the most famous set of cliffhangers in the Torah, the regular weekly sessions. And we're continuing with the story of Joseph. And if you recall where we left last week, we had the brothers who had previously sold Jacob a dozen or so years ago at this point into slavery down into Egypt, where he's had kind of a difficult time, and he has been in prison. Then in the last episode, he was released because the Pharaoh had a pair of dreams that he needed interpreted, and Joseph alone was able to do that. He gave the glory to Yah, but he ended up being the number two man in Egypt in a situation where he is put in charge, literally, of executing the plan that he outlined for Pharaoh, which is to gather grain for 7 years, and then when the famine that was prophesied comes along, there would be grain so that he could begin divvying it back out. And indeed, that's when the brothers, long having been parted, show up looking for some grain. He sends them home with some, manages to kind of play a, I guess you'd say a dirty trick on them, but it's all part of a plan. He puts their money back in their sacks, sends them home. They discover it. They're upset. And then, of course, they end up eventually coming back. And they do as they were told to do. You have to bring your brother Benjamin, which is, of course, the youngest son of the same mother, Rachel, along with them. And I got ahead of the story, didn't I? I skipped a whole bunch. I was looking ahead at this week's and thinking ahead to the next cliffhanger. So, pardon me on that score, folks. Sorry, I don't usually do that. But I was really into the story. Okay, so here we are. This is at the point where we should have picked it up. The brothers haven't yet come, but don't worry, we're going to get to that. It came to pass at the end of 2 full years now that Pharaoh does have those dreams that I've already kind of tipped off the story about. And he stands by the river. And, of course, probably by now most folks remember the dreams. Out of the river come up a bunch of cattle, 7 really good-looking, fat, luscious-looking ones. They feed in the reed grass. And then up come 7 others, not nearly as nice-looking, very lean, ill-favored. And they stood by the other ones on the bank of the river. And the ill-favored and lean-fleshed kine cattle literally ate up the 7 good ones. And this seems to have disturbed Pharaoh. He awoke. Then he goes back to sleep. He has yet another dream. Behold, this time it's 7 ears of corn that come up on one stalk, rank and good, and then 7 more ears of corn, thin and blasted by the east wind, spring up after them. And the same thing happens. The thin ears swallow up the rank and full ears. Pharaoh awakes, and wow, what a dream. So in the morning, his spirit was troubled. And he calls for all of the magicians of Mitzrayim, the so-called wise men, tells them what happened, and none of them could figure out what the interpretation was for him. Now, finally, the chief butler, after 2 years, remembers, hey, look, you know, I got a story to tell. And he says, to begin with, I make mention of my faults this day. Remember, Pharaoh was really upset with his servants. He put me in the ward of the house of the captain of the guard, along with the chief baker. And both of us each had our own dreams in the same night. And each one dreamed according to the interpretation. So in other words, my dream had one interpretation. The other dream of the chief baker had another. And there was this lad with us, a Na'ar, young Hebrew man, servant to the captain of the guard. We told him our dreams, and he interpreted them. And wow, came to pass exactly as he said it would. I was restored to my office. The other guy, not so good. He was hanged. So, after hearing this, Pharaoh immediately goes and calls for Joseph, get him up out of the dungeon. He shaves, changes his clothes, comes into Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says to Joseph, I have dreamed a dream, and there's no one here that can interpret it. And I've heard tell of you that when you hear it, you can do that. And here Pharaoh gets an answer from Joseph that he may not have been expecting. But it does seem like, at this point, the key is Joseph has very definitely learned to give credit where credit is due. It is not in me, he says. It's not me that's interpreting this dream. It is Elohim who will give Pharaoh an answer of peace, of shalom. And then Pharaoh tells Joseph the dream. He tells him almost word for word the same thing. Look, I was in the dream standing upon the bank of the river. Here come these seven fat flesh, nice good looking cattle. They feed in the reed grass. Seven others come up, not so good. And they're such as I never saw, he says, in all the land of Egypt, because they were nasty and bad. And then the lean and ill-favored cattle ate up the first seven fat ones. And when they'd eaten them up, it couldn't be known that they'd eaten them, because they still looked just as ill-favored as they did to begin with. So I woke up. And then he says, I saw in my dream, behold, this time it's seven ears of corn come up on one stalk, full and good. And then behold, seven ears, withered thin, blasted by the east wind, sprung up after them, and the thin ears swallowed up the seven good ears. And I told it all to the magicians, but no one there could declare to me what it was that this meant. So Joseph says to Pharaoh, the dream of Pharaoh is in fact echad. These are a unified set, if you will. What Elohim is about to do, he has declared unto Pharaoh. Now, at this point, I want to stop and just make note of something that you will see in the Midrash. It's a good observation, and I'll throw it out there and say, okay, I find some merit in it, but not necessarily what I go to the place where it usually is gone among the rabbinical types. And that is that you will see reference after reference in here to Elohim, which is the name for the plural. It's in the Hebrew it's plural, but of course it is the name for the Creator. And the implication, say the Midrash, is that this is a name that all of the world should know him by, simply as the one true God, if you will. And the reason why that seems important in here is because you see it, that Pharaoh gets the message all through this interpretation process. Here is Joseph saying, it's not in me, it's Elohim who is going to give Pharaoh an answer. And then when he makes reference several times, as a matter of fact, seven times in here, he uses that term, Elohim. He says to Pharaoh here, for example, the dream of Pharaoh is echad. What Elohim is about to do, he has declared unto Pharaoh. The seven good kind are 7 years. Seven good ears are 7 years. The dream, again, is echad. This is the same. And the seven lean and ill-favored kind, or cattle that came up after, are also 7 years. Same thing for the seven empty ears blasted with the east wind. They're echad as well. And there are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I spoke unto Pharaoh. What Elohim is about to do, he has shown unto Pharaoh. So behold, here's what's going to happen. You're going to have 7 good years of great plenty throughout all of the land of Mitzrayim. And then after them, there'll be 7 years of famine. And they're going to be so nasty that the years of plenty will literally be forgotten in the land of Mitzrayim, and the famine will consume the land. And the plenty shall not be known in the land by reason of that famine that follows. It's going to be something to behold, very grievous. And that is why the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice. And here's another one of those places where I will stop, because it's an important point. Scripture tells us that we get two witnesses. And one of the principles that we see in the dream interpretation, we've seen it all through the story of Joseph, is that essentially you will get a repetition, or if not a repetition, a second witness is a better way to put it, of these dreams. It happened with Joseph, and we're seeing it here with Pharaoh as well. So what does that mean? It means the Debarim, the Debar, the word, the thing, is now established by Elohim, and Elohim is about to bring it to pass. So therefore, he says, here's what needs to happen. Let Pharaoh seek out a man who is both discreet and wise. Nabon ve Hacham. And let him be set over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this. Let him appoint overseers of the land. Take up a fifth part of the land of Egypt. In other words, out of the excess in these years of plenty, take 20%, set it aside for those 7 years. Then let him gather all the food of those good years that come, lay up this corn, this grain, in the hand of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. And that will be a store in the land against the 7 years of coming famine, which will be in the land of Egypt, and the land will perish not. If you do this, in other words, if you'll set aside for the rainy day, people and life will be preserved. So the thing it says was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all of his servants. And Pharaoh asked his servants, kind of a rhetorical question, I think, can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the spirit of Elohim? And then Pharaoh says to Joseph, for as much as Elohim has shown you all of this, there is none so discreet and wise as you. So, again, here's the interesting point. This is a pagan. This is Pharaoh, got lots and lots of gods in the land of Mitzrayim, but it does seem in this particular case that Pharaoh is showing deference to the God that has just now revealed himself to him through his own dreams and through the hand of the Hebrew servant who is now interpreting those things correctly, and it has the ring of truth, obviously, and furthermore, he's going to make him number two man. So then he says, you shall be over my house. According to all your word will all of my people be ruled. And only in the throne alone will I be greater than you. So he is going to be truly number two. Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I've set you over all of the land of Mitzrayim. He took off the signet ring from his hand, a symbol of authority, puts it on Joseph's hand. He arrayed him in vestures of fine linen, put a gold chain around his neck, and made him ride in the number two chariot. So this would be not Air Force Two, but Chariot Two. Which he had, and they cried before him, Abrech, and he set him over all the land of Mitzrayim. And then Pharaoh said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without you shall no man lift up his hand or his foot in all of the land of Mitzrayim. And he gave Joseph a new name. He called him Zaphenah Paneah. And he gave him to wife the daughter of Potipharah, a priest of On, named Asenath. And there may be some confusion with the names here, but doesn't seem like most of the scholars tend to think that this is any relation to the Potiphar that he was already dealing with that sent him off to prison. Would be kind of a fitting tribute if it was, but looks like that's a title which was not that particularly unique. Anyway, then Joseph went out over the land of Egypt, and at this point it says he was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh, and he went throughout all the land of Egypt. And then we had the 7 years of plenty, exactly as prophesied. The land and the earth, haaretz, literally brought forth in heaps, abundantly. And the root there is le kametzim, handfuls. So he did as he had said he would do. He gathered up all the food in those 7 years, laid up the food in the cities, food of the field, and it was round about in every city laid up in the same. Now, interestingly, I can remember just within the last few years seeing some excavations in Egypt of some great, big, huge cement line, or at least stone-lined pits. I guess you could say storage facilities. Huge things. And at least one of them was found outside of an ancient city, and there was some archaeological scratching of the head, right? What is this? And the answer seems to be fairly obvious. This is one of the places that was built for grain storage. But in any case, Joseph laid up corn as the sand of the sea, whole lots of it, until they left off numbering it because it was so much in abundance. And under Joseph, at this point, of course, through his new wife, we have two sons that are born to Asenath. Joseph called the name of the first one Manasseh, for Elohim has made me forget my toil and all my father's house. And basically, Manasseh is a more or less a reference to it's all him. He's pointing to the Creator. The name of the second he called Ephraim, for Elohim has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction, and literally double fruitful there. 7 years of plenty came, and then they came to an end. And next come the 7 years of famine, just as Joseph had said. And there was famine in all the lands, but in Egypt, at least, thanks to the foresight, there was bread. And when all the land of Egypt was famished, people cried out to Pharaoh, give us food, give us bread. And he said to the Egyptians, go find, seek out, see Joseph. And what he says to you, do. So there was famine all over the face of Haaretz, the earth. Joseph opened up all the storehouses that he'd built and filled, sold to the Egyptians. The famine was sore in the land of Egypt. Now notice this. I'm going to pause just a second. The people have been taxed, if you will, and they're going to have to pay for the grain. He doesn't just give it out, it sounds like. He literally charges them for it. And I think in terms of a message today, for those that would say that the Bible is a socialist document, not so. Not even in a land of Egypt, and we'll have some other parallels with Egypt and slavery here later. Anyway, other countries too came to Egypt and also to Joseph, therefore, to buy corn, because the famine was sore all over the earth. Now, Jacob saw. Remember Jacob up north? He sees that, in fact, there was food to be had, corn in Egypt. He says to his sons, "Why are you looking at one another? Behold, I've heard there is corn down there in Egypt, or grain or food stuff. So go on down and buy for us so that we might live and not die." Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn from Egypt, but Benjamin, the youngest, stayed home, lest, said Joseph, his father, peradventure harm befall him. So the sons of Israel came to buy among all those that came. So they're making the pilgrimage along with lots and lots of other people. And Joseph, of course, was governor over the land. It was he is the one that did the selling. And Joseph's brethren came. They bowed down to him with their faces to the earth. And Joseph recognizes them. He knew them. But it says he made himself strange. Now, his appearance is probably altered. For one, he's a bunch older. Two, he's dressed like a traditional Egyptian. Not speaking the language they remember. And he spoke roughly with them, and he said unto them, "From where have you come?" "Well, the answer is the land of Canaan. We're here to buy food." So it says in verse 8, just to make sure we understand, Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew him not. And he remembered the dreams which he had dreamed. And it's interesting how the translation is set here. Is it of them or is it for them? And he says to them, "You are spies. I know it. You've come to see the nakedness of the land. You've come to spy out the weaknesses of the land." "No, no, my lord, that's not why we're here. We have come, your servants, in fact, to buy food. And we're all the sons of one man. We're upright men. Your servants are not spies." "No," he says, "I'm not buying it. You've come to see the nakedness of the land." "Well, we, your servants, are 12 brethren, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Behold, the youngest this day, he's home with our father, and one is not." In other words, one has perished. Joseph says to them, "Well, that's what I said to you. Yep, you are spies, not buying it. So here is the test. We'll see. As Pharaoh lives, you will not go forth hence unless your youngest brother comes hither. So send one of you, let him fetch your brother, and you shall be bound that your words may be tested. Whether there is truth in you or not, or else as Pharaoh lives, yep, you guys have shown me you're really spies." So he put them all together into a ward. He bound them in a prison for 3 days. Joseph then on the third day says, "This do and live, for I fear HaElohim." Right there almost ought to be a tip-off. But we'll go on through and says, if you're upright men, let one of your brethren then be bound in the prison house. I'll leave all of you go except for one. And you can go back and carry corn unto your houses. Because obviously there are people that need the food. And then when you come back, you bring your youngest brother with you unto me, so that your words can be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. Now here's where the plot really thickens. They said to one another, "We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear him. And that is why this evil has come upon us." And then Reuben. Now remember, Reuben is the firstborn. And the general understanding in the Midrash, and I tend to think this makes perfect sense, is that the firstborn, of course, is considered to be the leader among the brothers. And it was Reuben, therefore, that it would seem Joseph all of these years has been blaming for what happened. He's the one that takes responsibility. Firstborn is the one that is the primary inheritor. He's the leader of the house after the father goes. So it makes sense that Joseph would hold him largely responsible.
But here's Reuben speaking up. He says, didn't I tell you, saying, did not sin against the child, but you wouldn't listen to me? So therefore, behold, his blood is required. Now, Scripture at this point pauses and says, look, understand this. They didn't realize Joseph understood them, because the interpreter was normally the one who did the translating. And they don't realize he speaks Hebrew. So he turned himself about from them and wept. He, Joseph, is hearing this, and he's overcome with emotion. Think about it. He's learned a lot that he didn't know. And the fact that there seems to be repentance going on is what's really getting to him. And he wept. And he returned to them, and he spoke to them, and he took Shimon, Simeon, from among them, and he bound them before their eyes. Now, a couple questions, right? He has just heard that the one who is number one and probably responsible is the one who they didn't listen to. So if you think about it, who would be the next logical choice in line? Yeah, number two. So he binds Simeon. And Rashi adds one interesting comment here. When somebody says, here comes the dreamer, he takes this understanding to mean, yeah, this is probably Shimon, Simeon, who said, here comes the dreamer as well. And while you can't prove that part from Scripture, you can essentially make the pretty good case that Joseph has made the logical choice here of the number two if the number one isn't the one responsible. So, Joseph commanded their vessels be filled up with corn and to restore every man's money to his sack. And he gave them provision for the way, and thus it was done for them. So, he basically gets them ready to head them up and move them out. They laded their asses with their corn, and they headed up and moved out. And eventually they pause. One of them opens his sack to give some food to his ass along the way at the lodging place. And uh-oh, what is that in there? He spies the silver, the kesef, right there in the mouth of his sack. And he says to his brethren, oh no, well no, I added that part, folks. My money is restored. Lo, it's here, right in my sack. And their hearts failed them. They turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that Elohim has done to us? We've had it. They came back to Jacob, their father, when they got home up into the land of Canaan. They told him all that had befallen them, and they said the following, this man, the Lord of the land, he spoke pretty roughly with us. He took us as spies. We told him, no, we are good guys. We're not spies. 12 brothers, sons of one father. One is not. The youngest is with us today and with our father in the land of Canaan. And the man, he says the following to us. Look, here's how I know you're upright men and not spies. Leave one of your brethren with me. You can take some corn for the famine and go back up to your houses, go your way. And then when you come back, and he knew that they would, you bring your youngest brother unto me. That's how you'll prove to me that you're not spies. But since you're upright men, I will deliver you, your brother, and you will traffic in the land. So it came to pass that when they all emptied their sacks, oh, there it is, every single bit of money that they had sent, kesef was in their sack. And when the father, Yaakov, saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. So Yaakov, the father, says to them, me you have bereaved of my children. Joseph is not. Now Simeon is not. And you intend to take Benjamin away too? Upon me have all of these things come. Well, now it's Reuben who speaks up, right? Firstborn. He's in the position of presumed authority. Doesn't sound, though, like he kind of nails it here. I wouldn't be real swayed by this speech. He says, look, you can kill my two sons if I don't bring him to you and deliver him into my hand. I'll bring him back. Nope, says Jacob. My son isn't going to go down with you. Not with an attitude like that. His brother's dead. He's the only one that's left of that mother. If harm befalls him by the way which you go, then you'll bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave. And the next chapter tells us that, the famine was in fact sore in the land. And as you might expect, they ate for a while, but eventually they run out of corn, and it's time to go back down. And their father says to them, all right, go down again, buy us a little food. Well, this time it's Judah who spoke up, and he says the following. The man earnestly did warn us. He said, you will not see my face unless you bring your brother with you. So if you'll send our brother with us, we'll go down and buy food. But if you won't send him, we might as well not bother. Because the man said to us, you will not see my face unless your brother is with you. Now notice that up until this point in the story, Yaakov has been Yaakov. He does in fact have a new name, and Scripture tends to use them carefully. And it's this point where Israel, not Yaakov, first time we've seen it in this part of the portion this week, Israel says, "Why therefore have you dealt so ill with me? Why'd you tell the man you even had a brother?" Well, they said he asked. He asked straight out. And he asked about our kin, saying, "Is your father yet alive? Have you another brother?" And this ought to be another clue, but doesn't sound like as of yet, you know, we're seeing it. And we told him, according to the tenor of these words, how could we in any way know he was going to say, "Then bring him on down"? Then Judah says to Israel, again, here it is, Israel, his father, "Send the lad with me. We'll arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones." Now, if you think about the logic here, it's pretty compelling. Look, if Benjamin doesn't go with us, you're all dead anyway, right? So if you think about it, Dad, you might as well. And furthermore, here's the part where Judah continues the process we saw with Tamar. He is assuming a position of leadership. I like to refer to it as he's manning up. "I'll be surety," he says, "for my youngest brother. Of my hand shall you require him. If I bring him not back unto you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever." He doesn't say something stupid like, "You can go kill some of my children." He basically says, I am going to be the one who is going to take responsibility. Because look, if we hadn't lingered, we'd have had to have returned by now a second time anyway. So their father Israel then says to them, he's Israel now, these last three references, "If it be so, now do this. Take of the choice fruits of the land in your vessels. Carry the man some presents," right? Take him a little balm, a little honey, some spicery, some ladanum, nuts and almonds. Don't have a lot of corn, but they got some of these other things. "And take twice the amount of kesef of silver in your hand, and the money that was returned to you, take that back too. Maybe it was an oversight. And also, take your brother and arise and go back and see the man." And he says, "El Shaddai, give you mercy before the man, that he may release unto you your older brother." He's still thinking about Simeon and Benjamin. "And as for me, if I'm bereaved of my children, I am bereaved." The men then took that present. They took twice the kesef in their hand, and they took Benjamin. They rose up and they went on down to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, and eventually they stood again before Joseph. And this time, Joseph, I'm sure, has been waiting. Here it is. He sees Benjamin. He says to the steward of the house, "Bring the men into the house, kill the beasts," right? Kill the fatted calf, the biblical reference from elsewhere. "Prepare the meat. These men are going to dine with me at high noon today." The men did as Joseph bade them to do, and they brought him into Joseph's house. But the brothers were sore afraid because they were brought into the house. And they said to one another, that money, that kesef that was returned in our sacks the first time we brought it in, he's been looking for something against us. And he'll fall upon us and take us all into bondage, us and our asses. And yeah, the modern English there is almost precious, right, in the way that it reads. "They came near to the steward of Joseph's house. They spoke to him at the door of the house, and they said, 'Oh, my Lord, we did indeed come down the first time to buy food. And it came to pass, Shazam, when we looked, when we got to the place where we were staying for the night, we opened up our sacks, and behold, every man's money was right there. We brought it back in our own hands. We brought, furthermore, other money in our hand to buy food. We don't know what happened, how that got in there, but, basically what they're implying is, we didn't do it. And he said, 'Peace be unto you, fear not, your Elohim and the Elohim of your father has given you treasure in your sacks. I had your money.' And he brought Simeon out to them." So the man brought the men into Joseph's house. He gave them water. He washed their feet. He gave their asses provender, food. And they made ready all the stuff that they had brought, the presents, when Joseph comes at noon. Because they'd heard they were going to dine with him. When Joseph comes home, they brought him the present that was in their hand right into the house. They bowed down to him to the earth. Right? Full pause. Does this sound like a dream that we've seen and heard about before? Yep.
and he asked them of their welfare. And he said, that old man that you talked about, your father, is he yet alive? Yep, they said. The servant, your servant, right? Thy servant, our father, he is well and he is yet alive. And they bowed the head and they made obeisance. And he lifted up his eyes and he sees Benjamin, his brother, his mother's son. And he says, as if he doesn't know, is this the youngest brother of whom you spoke to me? And then he says to Benjamin, Elohim be gracious unto you, my son. Joseph made haste at this point because his heart literally yearned. I think he wanted to give his brother a hug, right? Or the equivalent. And he looked for some place to go out of sight and literally cry his eyes out. He entered into his chamber and he wept there. Then he washed himself up and he came out and he refrained himself and he said, all right, bring on the grub. Feed us, bring the bread. And they set on for him by himself. So basically, they're in the same room, it sounds like, but Joseph is going to be at a different table. They ate at one table or one place, the Egyptians, by themselves, because the Egyptians do not eat bread with Hebrews. That was considered an abomination unto them. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, the youngest according to his youth, and the men marveled. In other words, they didn't arrange themselves. They had place settings, I guess, and Joseph told them where to sit. And he got them all right, got them all in order. Portions were taken, but the one that Benjamin got was five times bigger than any of theirs. That they ate, and they drank, and they were merry with him. And finally, he commanded the steward of the house. He said, fill the man's sacks with food, as much as they can carry. Put the money back in the sack's mouth. Oh, and my goblet, the silver goblet, put that in the sack's mouth of the youngest. In other words, Benjamin, along with his corn money too. And the servant did exactly what Benjamin told him to do. And when first light came in the morning, they were sent away along with their asses. And they hadn't gone too far out of the city when Joseph then says to his steward, look, head them up, follow after them. And when you overtake them, say to them the following, why have you rewarded evil for good? Is that the way that my Lord drinks? And that's why he is. Is it not this cup, in other words, in which my Lord drinks? And whereby indeed he divines, have you done this evil? And the servant, in fact, overtook them as he was told to, and he spoke to them the words that he was commanded. And they said to him, why are you telling us this? Far be it from your servants that we should do any such thing. Look, the money which we found in our sack's mouths, we brought back to you. Remember last time? How then should we steal out of your Lord's house anything, silver or gold? And furthermore, they said the following, with whomsoever of your servants it's found, let him die. And we also will then be bondservants to you. All right, says the servant, let it be according to your own words. He with whom it is found shall be my bondman, and you shall be blameless. So it's according to his own words, but he's not necessarily telling them that he's going to kill whoever it is. So they hastened, they took down their sacks, every man opened up his sack, and they searched, starting from oldest to youngest, and sure enough, guess where it was? Yep, it's right there where it was intended to be, in Benjamin's sack. So they rent their clothes, they loaded up their asses, and they headed on back into the city. And at this point, notice the way that it's phrased here. It says, and Judah and his brethren came to Joseph's house. He was still there. As if he didn't know what was going to happen, right? They fell before him on the ground. Joseph says to them, what is this deed you have done? Don't you know that a man like me can divine? Well, says Judah, what do we say to you, my lord? What can we say? How can we possibly clear ourselves? Elohim has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are, in fact, your bondmen, both we and also he in whose hand the cup was found. Says Joseph, far be it from me that I should do something like that. The man in whose hand the goblet was found, in other words, Benjamin, he shall be my bondman. You guys, you can go on up in peace, head on back to your father. All right. Well, and I was anxious, of course, to get to yet another cliffhanger. So that's where the cliffhanger this week ends. And I tend to want to think through the whole story. So, yeah, this is where I was eventually headed anyway. We are going to see the rest of the story. What happens next time? And we'll leave it there, because it is indeed a great story, and we've begun to see it. It's been foreshadowed, if you will, in a couple places. We've seen several asides to Judah, and the fact that Judah seems to be behaving as a genuine leader. And when we get back and pick up the story next week, we're going to see how that really comes to a head.
So come out of her, oh my people, for the time has come to judge Babylon. So come out of her, the time has come to judge Babylon. For her sins have reached unto the heavens.
I won't begin the teaching yet, but I will begin some discussion, and there might be some questions. It was actually a couple of questions that kind of inspired me to start just a minute early and do some of this kind of thing, because it's at least peripherally related to what I want to talk about today anyway, and the theme of the Torah portion, which is kind of an in-between Torah portion anyway. So here we go. The question, and I think it was Keeps that asked it, but there were a whole bunch of them that came along the same lines, having to do with the upcoming minimum, the solar minimum, and the ones that are in the past, as you may remember, were called the Maunder minimum and the Dalton minimum. There was an earlier one 200 years before that. These have been well known for a while, unless, of course, you get your news from the Criminally Negligent Network or some of the others. And as people are, I think they're going to be very angry when they realize that they could have been preparing for what's coming for years. And instead, not only have they been told not to prepare, they have been deliberately, lied to. And so many things that they could have done, for example, have been destroyed. I mentioned this. Okay, so here's where we're at. The question was, how long will it be until people wake up? Now, that's not the way she phrased it, I guess. Let me see if I can find it exactly here, because I like the way she phrased it. Mark, when is this ice age, the mini ice age that's being called, going to hit? And my response, of course, is that it's literally been hitting for a long time. And, gee, that's kind of confusing. I suggest that it will be obvious when people can no longer deny it. And that's the only time when it'll be widely said to have actually hit. And, you know, other wags online were pointing out, oh, well, they'll blame it on Trump. And, indeed, that's the plan and so forth. Because the Paris Climate Accords, even here in the room, there were people saying, oh, you know, it's amazing to me how many snowflakes are still saying, oh, well, there may be global cooling, but it's because of man-made global warming. Okay, it's kind of like, I skidded into that turn because I didn't know how to drive, so it must be the car's fault or something. There's just so much wrong with the logic that says, because I can't acknowledge the facts, even when they freeze me to death in the cold, I'm going to blame global warming and something that I've been ignorant of by design for years. So here we go. The question is an interesting one, and I want to make sure everybody understands this. So if there are questions in response to my answering the questions, put those up too. I've frequently talked here about cycles and the fact that if you look at the universe and the way the Creator designed the universe, you see a whole lot of things that, they're called underdamped or overdamped exponentials, but you know, the mathematics gets kind of complicated, but in a way it's really simple. Almost everything in the universe are either orbits like planets, or if you take an orbit and kind of project it mathematically onto a plane, what you end up with is a sine wave. Or something that looks a lot like a sine wave, or a cosine wave, or whatever. Okay, people are scratching their heads and going, what the heck is he talking about? All right, physically, the simplest explanation has to do with a pendulum. Right? If you swing a pendulum, everybody's seen a pendulum. You know what happens is it swings from the right, and it goes up to a peak, and then it slows down as it gets towards the top, and it slowly stops, and it turns back around. And as it goes back down towards the point at which it would rest, if it was hanging still, the zero cross point, the bottom of its arc, think about it, that is the place where the pendulum is moving the fastest. And then it swings up the other way, and it slows down until it gets to a peak. And then it reverses, and it goes back cycle after cycle. Now, if you were actually to try and draw that cycle on a piece of paper, you end up with what looks like, if you've ever seen the old monster movies, the oscilloscope, the little display of something that looks like a bunch of sideways S's connected together. That's a sine wave. And every double E knows it well. We have all kinds of things that make sine waves, and literally all radio waves and electromagnetic waves, they're variations on a theme of sine waves. Now, here's the key, and this is where I'm going to get, this will be maximum nerdiness here for just a second. If you look at the sine wave, understand that it too, like the pendulum, very same concept and process, is moving fastest. The rate of decline is the fastest as it goes through what's called the zero cross. And then it begins to go, just like the pendulum, at the bottom and move back up. All right, what's this got to do with the sun? Well, the sun, too, has cycles, and guess what? So I'm being told, oh, yeah, don't forget the positive and negative parts. All right, in a pendulum, you have the right side of the swing and the left side of the swing. On a piece of paper, what usually you do is you put a zero place in the middle, and the sine wave spends half its time above the line and half its time below the line, and that line is called the zero cross. So the point at which the sine wave moves through the zero is the zero cross. That's where it's moving fastest. All right, so back to the question that was asked about, when will the ice age hit? And picture, if you will, right, submitted for your approval, that maybe 20 years ago, we had maximum warmth. We had literally a period that has been likened to other periods in history where we had a whole lot of uncharacteristically warm weather worldwide. Longer summers, milder winters, and a whole lot of stuff. And yes, there are other factors like El Nino and La Nina and the Pacific, low pressure and high pressure zones, all those kind of things have effects. The jet stream has effects. But by and large, the driver for all of them is the sun. So the sun was nice and warm, toasty warm, pretty and yellow and wonderful. And for a long time, people thought, well, this is the way it's going to be. Most of us that are listening today grew up and spent our lives during a period of uncharacteristically warm weather. Well, guess what, folks? The world is returning to what's more normal. And a lot of us ain't going to like it. And what we're doing now is, if you followed the debate about non-existent man-made global bogus science, BS, called global warming, there hasn't been any. Hadn't been any global warming for at least about 18 years at this point. Right back to the sine wave. Remember, when the sine wave hits its positive peak at the very tippy top and it starts heading down, it's moving very slowly for a while. So you have summers that aren't quite as warm, but hey, they're still nice and toasty warm. And they get cooler and cooler, and things cool off slowly. And because of all the circulation and variations, people don't notice that the average really is getting cooler. And if you have honest science, you do. But if you have dishonest science, like what we've seen over and over again with the Climate Research Unit in East Anglia in Britain and the UN's IPCC, the paid whores who basically lie about and manipulate the data and fudge the numbers, and things like the heat island effects, where cities grow out towards the airports where the data is taken, and more concrete means it really does get a little warmer. But hey, that doesn't mean the planet's getting warmer, just that the area around where the measuring is being done is warmer. So for all of those reasons, you can hide the fact that the pendulum is swinging back the other direction for years. They've managed to lie about it now for close to 20 years. So here we are. Again, the question, when will the ice age get here? Well, folks, we haven't yet, I don't think, quite even gotten to the zero cross point. We're heading down, and we're heading down faster and faster every year. So that's the key. As the cold wave accelerates, in other words, as the sun's energy output drops, and it's still being lied about, the cooling accelerates. But we ain't near where we're headed yet. But we are also getting pretty close to the point of maximum change. In other words, the point of that zero cross when people say, wow, it's still not really that cold, so you guys have been talking about the ice age must be full of it. But the rate of change is at its peak. Are you with me? That allows stupid people, people who've been dumbed down, people who have a vested interest in lying, to keep lying for longer. because the rate of change is hard to deny if you actually look at the figures honestly. But it's also hard to deny, well, we're not nearly as cold as people have been saying we're going to be. Well, don't worry. Here's the point. We are still years, maybe decades away from the bottom. And we don't know yet how deep the bottom is going to get. Right? There were periods during the previous Dalton minimum and Maunder minimum where literally there was a year in the early 1800s called the year without a summer. There are other things that happen, too, associated with volcanism and so forth that we, we're actually seeing, right, increases in volcanoes and earthquakes worldwide, earthquakes in diverse places. So all of these things are coming to pass. And the question, and the way that I tried to answer the question, right, when will the little icy age be here? Well, it won't be here till people wake up and realize it. And the problem is by the time they do, there'll be a whole lot of dead people. Because there are several things that are also part of the reason why I decided to spend a few minutes and get started early here with this. There are also a lot of things that will happen that are going to shock folks who have been lied to because they'll even be necessary. And the thing that I mentioned online that I'm sure caught a few people off guard, here we are in Colorado, okay? I'm at 9,000 feet, as most of you know. This is an area where we get summers that are pleasant, but not by any means hot relative to places like where I grew up, Missouri, where 100 degrees and 100% humidity is considered kind of a normal July day. Yuck. So we don't get that. But we do get, you know, nice 85 degrees. Occasionally we'll hit 90 kind of weather in the wintertime. Yes, we get lots of days down where we might not get above freezing or where we have lows that are down below zero sometimes. Not as much so as at lower. But the point is, that's what a Floridian would call really, really cold. Or a South Texan, or a person that grew up in Louisiana, or even Los Angeles. That's cold. All right, well, it's relative. But the pipes here are buried pretty deep. And we have heating systems that are designed to endure cold and frost. You get far enough north, Minnesota and places like that, they have problems that we are still thinking about. And that is, do you know that LP gas can freeze in the lines? Doesn't happen until it gets 30 below, but the people in Minnesota and a lot of folks in Canada are well aware of that. Now think about it. There are going to be temperatures all over the world that people that have grown up in a particular climate regime have never seen. I know that almost every year of late, you get the orange belt in Florida where they have orange groves and things like coconuts and so forth. Well, you can, in the times we've been to Florida in the past, there's almost like a band where you can drive south on the Florida Peninsula and there might be palm trees, but there's no coconut palms. And now all of a sudden, there's coconut palms. Well, what you've done is you've passed the region where all of a sudden, it don't frost no more. They don't get a frost. And that means coconut palms will grow because a frost will kill them. Well, guess what, folks? Here's my point. That line is going to move south. The line of frost will move south, may move all the way off the tip of Florida. And there will be areas in Florida and in South Texas that have never seen a frost. When we were down in Costa Rica, I remember looking at construction and seeing, wow, they just put pipes right above the ground. You got a water tank up the hill and a pipe that runs right down over the ground. Well, you don't have to bury it. Why bother? It never freezes here. They don't even know what they don't know. In other words, the concept of pipes freezing is so foreign to the Costa Rican plumber that never even asked themselves the question. Are you with me? Now, in Florida, you got a lot of people that have probably heard of freezing, but they don't worry about it because, no, it doesn't happen here. Well, it didn't. Not in our entire lifetimes, but it will. Are you with me? So there are going to be places in South Texas and in Florida and other places that have never seen a frost that will. And there are going to be huge infrastructure problems. Imagine tens of thousands of people that have never seen frost waking up to find frozen water all over their living rooms and all over their front yards and pipes burst and literally water coming out gushing everywhere and freezing. And it's already colder than they've ever seen before, but for crying out loud, now we're freezing to death in a pond. This is a mess. And the problem is these folks have been lied to. Rather than being told you've got 10 years to prepare for the coldest temperatures you've ever seen in your life in this area, they've been told not to worry, fear global warming. Hey, what are we going to do? We're going to spend billions of dollars and put crap in the sky. Load up planes with more. It's being done. They've been lying about it. More barium and aluminum and other so-called reflective materials, ice nucleation things, so we can cause it to snow when it's 45 degrees. Ain't that clever? And we can reflect sunlight that we're going to wish in a few years, like hell, that we had. I've been saying it for a while. People are going to be praying that we had global warming. Some of you have heard me rail for several years now about what was done by the Environmental Poisoning Agency, the evil EPA. What did they do? They outlawed a whole bunch of wood stoves, said these stoves aren't clean enough. Now, they're a hell of a lot cleaner than anything that was made for years. But they actually outlawed a whole bunch of perfectly good stoves, knowing, I think, full well, that there was going to come a time when lots of people would really, really have died, and will die, for those stoves, because they won't have any heat when the pipes burst, or when their natural gas is out, or when their power is out, and they got no ways to keep themselves warm. Well, a little bit of wood stacked up would be really nice in that situation. Some cheap wood stoves. What did EPA do instead? Well, they put new regulations in place. They raised the price of the new compliance stoves to the point where literally you had to be rich to buy one. I looked several years ago at putting in a wood stove. Going to be several thousand dollars minimum. That's if I did the work myself. Ridiculous. And in a lot of places, like the People's Republic of Boulder and the Front Range of Colorado, they got all these no-burn days where they're saying, hey, you can't burn anyway. Better to freeze to death. And what did they do with the old stoves? Well, they said this. Okay, if you want to turn in your perfectly good wood stove for a new compliant EPA Wonder Stove, we'll give you a credit. Right? It's going to cost several grand to buy this new stove. We'll give you $600 for your old stove. What did they do with the old stove? Sell it to some poor people who might use it during the coming ice age? Hell no! They crushed them. Took them away off the market. I learned this when I was in the process of trying to say, hey, you know, I'd be able to buy a good old Franklin stove, put it out in the barn for cheap. And I can have that when I really need it. No, you can't. We've destroyed them all. And the ones that are still around are antiques, and now they carry a huge price tag, too. So they've literally priced people out of the market. And I believe that those who were in a position of understanding knew darn well what they were doing. This is about control. This is about making sure that when this inevitable mini ice age comes, there'll be a whole lot of people that will freeze to death. So it's going to be really nasty. And I'm seeing the comments on the screen. Let me take a look and see if I missed anything. But I wanted to try to make this point as clear as I could, because I think it's part of the key, and it's part of the reason why people have been dumbed down. Most folks plain just don't have any understanding anymore of the equations that really run the universe, the way the Creator made things. Now, admittedly, it takes to really kind of get your head around how all of this is related. It takes a couple semesters of trigonometry or calculus, and it sounds daunting to a lot of folks. But if you've ever seen a picture of a sine wave or an oscilloscope screen in an old movie, you know what I'm talking about. It's not that complicated. So again, picture this. We are at a place on the solar cycle where temperatures are heading down. The thermosphere is showing that. This was a big story that came out. It didn't get much mainstream coverage, but the alternative press talked about it. NASA Langley Research. There's a fellow there that was writing about it. There's a mathematician named Valentina Zarkova that's produced some modeling of all of this. People like John Casey has written books for years. Casey was a former NASA official. And his book, Cold Sun and Dark Winter, two books that have made the point. This is not news. These cycles have been seen, well, in modern human history, we've seen 600 years worth, three full cycles. I mentioned the minimums. But, the press and the liars and the politicians can't be bothered to simply look at history, to read the stories out of the early 1800s, the 1600s. Look at what happened with the pilgrims. When did they come ashore? During the Maunder Minimum. Or is it the Dalton? I always get them mixed up. Anyway, the 1600s and the 1800s. And in both cases, things were cold like we're going to see cold. Yeah, okay, so this is the other comment from the Peanut Gallery here. If you look at the Dickens novels, okay, Dickens wrote about a time when the most of Northern Europe, and Britain in particular, got snow. Now, Britain has seen snow again, but Britain didn't get snow for decades. I remember being in London. You know, snow was unheard of in London, but if you look at the Christmas Carol, why, it was snow all over the place. Well, what's the difference? The difference was the sun. So back to the cycles again, just to make that point as clear as I possibly can. And if it's not, go ahead and ask the questions. But we are at a place where on the sine wave, the rate of change, winters are getting colder, and they're getting colder faster, okay? The Valentina Zarkova model suggests that 2019 will be the last summer that most of us will ever experience that's quote-unquote normal in our lifetimes. It'll probably be shorter, maybe not quite as warm as normal, but it'll be able to be laughed off or pawned off or lied about. Wait till the summer of 2020 and people will go, uh-oh, something is wrong. Something is rotten in Denmark. Well, Denmark has come to the southern United States in terms of the cold temperatures. So a lot of that stuff is on the horizon. And if you've heard me talk for very long, you know that it just really bugs me when people that are supposed to be entrusted with a position, they put their hand on a Bible, they lie. That irritates me no end. People that claim to be scientists, and they're whores instead, because they're taking money to lie to people. That really bugs me. And it bugs me even worse, folks, when people are going to die, freeze to death and starve to death, because they've been lied to about non-existent man-made global warming. And you know what, even it still bugs me, I hear people say, oh, well, you know, the ocean currents have changed and this has stopped. And the reason is global warming. Yeah, global warming is causing the cooling. What a bunch of idiots. This is stupid. It's beyond the pale. And not only that, I heard this, right? The problem is Trump withdrew from the Paris Climate Accords. Anybody who actually had half a brain and was paying attention to the Paris Climate Accords would tell you they didn't do, I gotta be kind and clean up my language, they didn't do bullpucky. The Paris Climate Accords were nothing but a panacea. The Chinese, biggest polluters in the world, weren't even covered. They didn't have to participate. Guess who was bearing the burden? Yeah, you already know. The Paris Climate Accords didn't do squat. So to say that pulling out of them is what's causing the problem is about like saying, well, I could give a whole bunch of examples. Most of them would be crude. But the point is, it's a lie. And all it takes is just a little bit of knowledge and understanding to realize how big of a lie it is. So, yes, comment from Charlotte on the screen about the chemtrails. Now, you got to understand modern terminology. Chemtrails, if you say chemtrails, you must be a conspiracy theorist. You must know what's going on. But you're not allowed to say chemtrails. You have to say geoengineering. That's a term that John Brennan, scumbag de tutte scumbags, was talking about. SAI, strategic atmospheric injection or something like that. Those are okay terms. You'll find those in the literature. You notice, folks, that people lie with words. And that's one of the other things that irritates me. You see, they have been messing with the climate, trying to reflect sunlight for years. And now that they've been caught, what are they doing? Coming right out and saying, well, we need to spend a lot of money because now things are really, really hurting. Gotta reflect the sunlight quickly. Why? You know why? So that when the winters come that are going to be cooler, they'll say, oh, it's because we've been helping. Yes, it's because we've spent billions of dollars to reflect sunlight. We're finally seeing some effects. See? That'll work for about 3 years until people finally are, you know, bodies are found frozen in the tundra in southern Missouri. And they go, bet those people didn't get the memo that they needed to have bought bikinis because of the global warming. So here we are. Where we're saying, okay, those of us that understand, those of us with eyes to see, are hopefully preparing. And, this is the question that I know will come up. You know, here we are speaking from a mesa at 9,000 feet, where, yeah, we get some pretty decent winters. I know our winters are going to be longer and cooler or colder. And that's going to be true across the entire United States. All right, where do people want to be? Well, I probably wouldn't want to be in Minnesota, but it's not because it's so stinking cold. It's because it's so stinking Sharia compliant. So there are other places, that might be warmer, but they're probably not going to be warm enough. Bottom line is there's an area across the central United States that's going to need to brace for a lot colder weather. But a lot of the people in that zone have probably already at least more or less prepared for it. They're not prepared for what's coming. but they're not going to be decimated, you know, when freezes that never happened before happen. So that's my advice to those that are in the really southern climates. Be prepared for things you've never seen before. The rest of us, you know, we need to be prepared for 10, 20 degrees colder than we've ever seen before, and for shorter growing seasons and longer winters. Part of the reason why I've been pushing greenhouses for years. I think the only way, and by the way, chemtrails are another reason. So for all of those reasons, you know, there are things people are going to have to do to survive, given what's coming. So, yes, and comment on the screen again about you don't need to be a college grad or mathematician to understand solar minimums. No, you don't. You can actually just look at the charts, and I really do recommend John Casey's books, because he has some really nice, easy-to-understand charts showing sunspots and showing global temperatures, and it's pretty obvious. There's a big sine wave there, and we're heading towards the bottom, towards the lower peak. And how deep it is, we don't know. Because guess what, folks? There are longer solar cycles than 200 years. And it might be that the bottoms of the 200-year cycle are getting deeper, too. So I'm just suggesting the following. All of us need to be prepared that from here forward, the rest of our lives, things are going to be different in terms of climate. It's got nothing to do with a non-existent man-made global warming. It's got everything to do with the sun and things that are going to be associated with it. And the time to be preparing for it is now. And yes, that's very important, too. Be aware of the fact that there are major plans, and I'm a conspiracy theorist, because there are people out there, one of the worst just died this week, and I won't say anything more. There are people out there that have been pushing for years to control and destroy billions on planet Earth. And this is all, they have known that it was going to be cold, and guess what they've been doing? Not only poisoning the water and producing genetically modified frankenfoods and building their underground nuclear-powered bunkers and stocking them with little boys and little girls and all kinds of nasty stuff, but they have literally been dumbing people down, destroying their immune systems, building up what are called binary or tertiary poisons in their systems so that they can be activated and lots of people can be killed. And guess what? See, if a lot of people die for other reasons, or there's a nuclear war or a nuclear winter, then they'll be able to say, that must have mitigated global warming. No, it didn't. It just gave you cover for what you knew was coming while you intended to kill billions of people anyway. So it's time for us to say we recognize the human heart's desperately wicked, but the evil that's coming is not just coming, it's here. Even if most of the world still is years away from waking up to it. Okay. So, yeah, vaccines, a lot of things on the screen. Let me take a quick peek and see if I missed any other questions. You guys, any local questions? Nobody we need to worry about. Okay. So, yes, it's like everything's breaking up at the same time. Question? Well, you mean physically shrinks? Well, no, there are things called... That's a very complicated question. And, in fact, when it comes to nuclear thermal, solar physics, there's a whole lot that astronomers have learned and then still don't know. But if you remember... Stars literally go through cycles. And as a star gets close to its end point, you have what they call the red giant phase. So at some point, as the sun really begins to go downhill, it will not get smaller, it'll get bigger. It'll cool off and it'll get much bigger. So complicated, but if you ever look in the planet or in the constellation Orion, there's a great big red star called Betelgeuse. And you can look at it with a telescope. It's very pretty and red. And Betelgeuse is huge. If we were a planet circling a star system like Betelgeuse, we would be inside the sun. So there comes a time, right? A new heaven or new earth. There comes a time when, all bets are off and the solar cycle will get big. There are things like supernovas at the end. So basically the sun gets big or the stars get big and then they can get small. They can collapse into a neutron star and go dark. Or they can not have enough mass to ever ignite in the first place, and then they can finally, they can supernova, they can do all kinds of things. So that's a whole different That's a whole different line. Thankfully, we're a long ways away from that. What we're seeing is just a tiny part of a sun which has, and binary stars do this. We have pulsars. You can look around the universe and read astronomy texts. There are it's very rare for a sun to have a star to have a stable output. Their nuclear fire situation changes. And what we're seeing is there's about a 200-year cycle, and there's longer cycles on top of that. So that's what we're witnessing now. And then beyond that, there's all kinds of other stuff, right? There's places in the universe where there might be more cosmic rays in different parts of the galaxy arms, and a lot of other stuff that are complicating factors. Okay. Just a brief comment, slightly off topic, but from Charlotte about she's heard that a lot of flus are from pigs. Back before mass genetic engineering and CRISPR and gene editing and bioweapons, back when, in other words, the only diseases were ones that were here that were put in places where the Creator warned us not to eat such things, every single major pandemic in human history, let me say that again, every single pandemic in history, the famous Spanish flu influenza outbreak after World War I and so forth, all of them came through pigs. The reason was because the pig DNA was so close to human that the various influenza viruses could jump the species barrier, which is, I think, part of the reason, not the whole reason, why we were warned in Scripture, don't eat those things, they're not food. So much of what we're talking about, in other words, has to do with warnings that were there for us all along, and if we only would just read them. In some cases, science is able to tell us why those were good warnings. In other cases, still not. But in almost every case, in every case I'm familiar with, as we learn more, we find out that science is finally beginning to verify that what Scripture told us all along was the right answer to begin with. And why didn't we listen? So with that, let me pause for a second, and I'll make a note. I'm guessing, since I've been seeing comments on the screen, that we have the ones. I don't guess I ever truly ask. Okay, or maybe I didn't see them. So let me say, Boker Tov, folks. Welcome back. Shabbat Shalom. Good morning. And let's talk about a whole lot of stuff this morning. I'll at the end of the recording, I'll probably edit some of that session that we had just had online and put that in, having to do with the idea of the coming mini ice age and the huge lies that Jeremiah the prophet warned us about. We've inherited from our fathers. A lot of these lies are going to end up getting a whole lot of people killed, sadly. And that's part of the reason why I get, angry about them. But let's talk about the Torah portion and also some of the other related scriptures this morning, like the HaTorah portion. This one is kind of an intermediate, too. And it's called Miketz. It starts in chapter 41 of Bereshit, or Genesis, and it says, "And it came to pass." Miketz Shnaim. Shnataim. I'll get it right yet. Anyway, 2 full years. It came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. And that's how the story begins. Now remember, here we are. This is kind of a series of Torah portions that I refer to as the cliffhanger set during the life of particularly Joseph, and his brothers, 11 at this point. There are, as you know, going to be more that end up being either grafted in or directly sons of Israel, of Yaakov. And this is the exposition phase of all of that. It begins with the story that we kind of talked about over the last couple of weeks, where Joseph is thrown in a pit by his brothers, sold into slavery. Then he ends up in the house of Potiphar. You have the unfortunate incident where he's accused of doing something that though shouldn't have gotten him thrown in jail, but should have gotten former presidents and a whole bunch of Hollywood types thrown in jail and didn't. Okay, he was righteous, they aren't, and there's another lesson in there. Anyway, when we ended the last portion, he has just interpreted the dreams for two folks, the butler and the baker, among the servants of Pharaoh. One of them ends up getting his job back, the other ends up being hanged. And, of course, Joseph asks, maybe this was a mistake, but he asks the chief butler to remember him. And at least for 2 years, he didn't. But at the beginning of this portion, it's going to come back to mind. And the story has to do with Pharaoh, of course, and his dream. I usually talk about this on a Rev Shabbat. Of course, I won't repeat the whole thing. But it's important to understand that the dream of Pharaoh is double. This is kind of characteristic of, a lot of things in Scripture. He gives us two witnesses. Comes the same way with dreams. He gave Pharaoh two witnesses. Same dream, kind of, but with slightly different metaphors involved. First time it's cattle, nice, chunky, good-looking ones, and lean, nasty ones that eat up the good-looking ones, seven of each. And then we have the same thing with ears of corn, seven of each. And he brings Joseph out of the prison, and Joseph stands before him after the chief butler says, oh, almost forgot, but now I remember there was this Hebrew lad. He was really good in interpreting dreams. So Pharaoh brings him up. Joseph does the right thing. This is key. When he is told by Pharaoh, hey, I've heard you can interpret dreams. No one else can do it, but you can. Nope, says Joseph. It's not me. It's Elohim who will give Pharaoh an answer of shalom, of peace. So Pharaoh tells him the dream. Joseph tells him, basically, you've had the same dream twice. They are echad. This is a unity of dreams. It was doubled because it means that the thing that the Creator, Elohim, is preparing to do, he is getting ready to do it shortly. Now, wait a minute. Here we go. Back to the idea that we've already just talked about of the mini ice age and the coming major climate change. Here's Joseph saying, you got 7 years yet. 7 years. He's going to shortly bring this thing to pass. But you got 7 years of plenty before we get to the nastiness. Now think about that. Do a quick compare and contrast. Here is a Pharaoh who seems to have more care that his people are protected in his kingdom than anything we've seen out of the deep state district of criminal swamp. There's a whole bunch of people. They've been lying in state for lying in state. They've been lying for decades. Has it been really clear to those that can simply read a chart that the solar output is eventually going to decline? We're going to have shorter growing seasons and global cooling? Well, it is unless you belong to the United Nations and subscribe to a bunch of BS masquerading as science. Pharaoh got the message. Now, this is the cool part, right? Pharaoh hears the dream. Now, I think Pharaoh has already recognized, hey, this young fellow is telling me the truth. Why? He can see the ring of truth, if you will. That's what we call it, the ring of truth, when something just kind of resonates and you go, yeah, I know, that's right. Non-existent global warming. No, that's not right. It's a lie. Okay? But here's the thing that I think is kind of amazing about this. It's 7 years. 7 full years before what Joseph is telling Pharaoh his dream suggests is going to come to pass. And yet, based on one hearing, Pharaoh takes this guy that he's never met before that day. Now, I bet he has done his research, right? The scriptures don't tell us this. I'm kind of guessing. He checked with the prison. He checked with Potiphar. And he's heard, there's something special about this young guy. This 30-year-old at this point. You better listen to him. I would be surprised if Pharaoh, being a good leader of the people, doesn't have some of his information sources, his little birdies that are telling him things, because he's asking. Again, Scripture doesn't tell us that. But what it does say is Pharaoh, when he sees him, says, yo, yeah, look here. There is no one so discreet and wise as you. I'm going to make you number two man in all of Mitzrayim, all of Egypt. Can you imagine that happening? Well, what would happen today, of course, in the White House is if the president tried to take somebody who wasn't a deep state Goldman Sachs alumni or something like that and say, I want to make him chairman of the Joint Chiefs. No. Or I want to make him a vice president. Well, what bribes has he taken? How has he shown that he cannot be trusted to keep his oath before God? Where's his track record of lying and cheating and stealing? No. They wouldn't approve him in the Senate. Thankfully, Pharaoh didn't have to have Joseph approved by a lying bunch of senators. He just said, there's no one as wise and discreet as you, so you're going to be number two. I'm going to put my signet ring on your hand. Done deal. And for 7 years, Joseph has carte blanche to do precisely what he has said he would do. And in all this time, can you imagine the rumors out there in the land of Egypt? Well, I hear there's a famine coming. Or maybe they've hidden it from us. I don't know. But there's a rumor, a conspiracy theory says we got some famine coming seven years out in the future. Well, most folks are going to say, like today, that's so far out, I could care less. Folks, we've had twice 7 years to prepare for the coming solar minimum. 15+ years that we know of that they've been lying to us. You can go back and see 80+ years ago, the Dust Bowl. It's not like climate cycles should be dramatic news. And it's not like, for crying out loud, the Industrial Revolution and man's burning of carbon fuels is somehow different this cycle. We've had many ice ages before and hot spells before when there was no massive SUVs or coal-fired power plants or anything of the sort. The cycle's been around a lot longer than mankind has been doing things to influence the climate, real or imagined. So, you know, when I look at this portion and I see the way it begins and this whole story of 7 years of good and 7 years of nasty, I can't help but think, wow, what a striking contrast to where we're at today, particularly when it comes to leadership and honesty. So Joseph does what he is commissioned to do. He stores things up for 7 years, and then, of course, along comes the zero cross, and all of a sudden, the years of plenty turn into years of famine. Now think about that, too. Okay, we go from years of plenty to years of famine. I am kind of suspicious that it was not like throwing a switch, that there was probably a transition year or two in there when maybe it wasn't quite as beautimous in terms of the harvest, the last year of plenty, and not quite as nasty, the first year of famine, as it was going to get in the year after. But regardless, by the time we get down several years into the famine, here comes Yaakov, Israel, sends the sons, says, better go get us some food. We're running kind of short here. So that's where the plot thickens. And, of course, Joseph, as we know, sees, recognizes his brethren. They don't know him. He looks like an Egyptian now. He doesn't speak the language, or at least they don't know. He still speaks the language. He accuses them of being spies. Looks like what's happening here in the latter part of the Torah portion for this week, just to kind of finish the discussion and set up the cliffhanger, is Joseph recognizes these are the guys who threw him in a pit and sold him into bondage for 22 years. Right? 2 decades plus. He was cooling his jets because his nasty brothers did something that they knew better than to do. Now, he doesn't know it yet, but he kind of figured it out, I'm sure. His dad thinks he's dead. All of this is eventually going to come out. And it's kind of fascinating, and it's another study in human relations, how it plays out. Whether he is gifted with this understanding from the Creator, directly or indirectly, we don't know. But basically, he gives them some clues. He tells them, hey, what about the youngest brother? You guys' youngest brother. Right? Go get him. So he hatches a plan because he knows that they're going to go home. They're going to run out of food because he knows this is going to last years longer than they yet understand. And they'll be back. And when they come back, he wants them to bring Benjamin. So he keeps one of them. Turns out that the one he originally thought, the firstborn, Reuben, who should be the fellow who is responsible, because he's the firstborn, he's the guy who kind of takes the hit for all the brothers. But he overhears, though, Reuben tried to talk him out of it, failed. So who is number two? Well, that would be Simeon, Shimon. So he's the one that gets hauled off and thrown in the dungeon, cools his jets, while the brothers go home and eat for a while. And he arguably learns something down there, too. So, you know the rest of the story. Again, I won't belabor that, but the point is, Joseph is right. The boys do, the young men, they actually do come back at this point. Now, when I say young men, obviously they're, some of them, over a decade older than he is, and he's 30. So they're, pushing middle-aged men at any rate. And they do finally bring home Benjamin, bring Benjamin back to Egypt with them, the next time. There's a really nice subtext in here, and it's one that I will probably focus on next week some more. It has to do with Judah and what I refer to as Judah manning up. We've seen now two clues or more to that. We saw the story of Judah and Tamar, where he finally gets it and admits, hey, she is more Torah observant, more righteous than I. And that's a good thing. So there's kind of step one along the path. Step two, I would suggest, probably happens when he doesn't say, oh, you know, like my older brother said, you can kill my sons if I don't come back. No, no, that's not going to fly with Dad. I know better than that. I will be surety for him, says Judah. You can literally take it out of me. Blame me. Let me bear the blame forever if I don't bring Benjamin back like I promise you that I will, Dad. And indeed he does. And we'll see that. But the Torah portion ends with the brothers coming before Joseph. And, of course, Benjamin gets a not just a double portion. Benjamin gets five times the stuff. Joseph has yet one more plan to hatch when he loads them up and heads them back out with all the goodies they came to get, all the food. And that is, not only does he put the money back in their sacks, but he puts his silver goblet in there too, hides it in Benjamin's sack so that he'll have an excuse for keeping Benjamin. At this point, it seems like he doesn't care what happens with the other brothers yet. He has not yet seen the kind of change that he is going to see in their attitude. Now, he recognizes there's at least some attempt at repentance. And this is cool. This is good. This is part of the process. And it's also part of, I guess, what I would say is the central lesson that I want to emphasize today in this Torah portion, the idea of trust but verify. That's Ronald Reagan's old favorite phrase, if you remember, in dealing with the Soviet Union. Turned out to be pretty successful. Too bad we don't have people in office today. Well, we have a guy in the White House, at least, the alleged commander-in-chief that would like to do that. But his hands seem to be tied, and there are a whole lot of people who would really much prefer nuclear war, and they're working hard on that score. So you don't hear much about trust but verify anymore. But what you hear about is Russia, 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 let's kill them all, and let's, if they nuke us, great, because we wanted a lot of you folks dead anyway. Joseph is going to do trust but verify, however. And he's not that trusting, right? He puts the money, he gives himself the excuse that he needs. And again, we'll see how all of that plays out next week. But the thing I'm trying to emphasize here is there are some lessons in this portion that we can learn. And one of them has to do with the time frame. How long Pharaoh was willing to wait. How long Joseph was willing to wait to watch the things that have been prophesied play out. Now, we would say 7 years sounds like a long time. But honestly, it's not. I mean, I can remember a lot of things I've waited for a lot longer than 7 years. Some I'm still waiting for. Does seem like a long time. It seems like we've had global cooling for a long time, too, even though we've been lied to about it. And then, of course, as this plays out, right? Let's put this back into the current situation and draw some parallels. Those of us that are paying attention understand that there is an economic collapse coming. Those of us that are paying attention understand that there are a whole lot of people who would really like to see war. They don't seem to really care who. Syria's okay. Afghanistan's okay. A lot of money to be made there. Russia's great. We'll push them really hard. China, yeah, that's inevitable. We want war everywhere all the time. We'd like a domestic war, too. Let's see if we can't get black against white, transgender against cisgender. You ever heard the term cisgender before? Yeah, that's people that know what they got between their knees. And they like the other kind. That didn't used to be an issue. Now it is. Something's wrong. Okay? The whole point is, lots of people trying to divide people by all kinds of methods that you'd have thought at one time might be obvious. Man against woman, black against white. But now we got people that know what sexuality is and people that don't. People that can see and use their hands and people that would rather just be mooches and leeches and so forth. Lots and lots of ways to divide people, and most of us probably never even thought a half of them up until we've seen it demonstrated for us on CNN. Got a question? Okay, question on the screen. Sorry. Was Joseph testing his brothers to see if they would do to Benjamin what they had done to him? Interesting. Yeah, that's one way to put it. It's probably not the way I would have put it, but it's a good way to ask it. Because remember, what does Benjamin have in common with Joseph? Well, not only is he the youngest, Joseph was not quite the youngest, but he was close. And they are both children of their same mother, Rachel. They're Rachel's two boys at this point. And he was obviously kind of discriminated against for several reasons growing up. I'm sure he has, and we know that he has some issues with all of that. Sounds like he certainly has an affinity for Benjamin, and he wants to make sure Benjamin is protected. So I am, was he testing the brothers to see if they would do to Benjamin what they had done to him? If nothing else, in other words, would they throw Benjamin under the bus, or under the camel, I guess you'd say back then, in order to escape with their own hide? And we're going to see that. So, yeah, there's an element of that. I think, though, if I had to phrase it the way I would say the test is bigger than that. And maybe the test is even bigger than he, Joseph, thought it was going to be. Because what he's really going to see is whether the boys have matured, whether they have really made teshuva or not. He is going to see what Judah is made of. And that's the really good news here. So, yeah, I think at a minimum he was looking to see would they throw Benjamin under the bus, in which case he'd just leave Benjamin there in Egypt, and that'd be fine. But as it's going to turn out, no, there's a much bigger plan, and here's where the plan of Yah comes in. And that kind of leads me back, great question for the transition anyway, to this trust but verify thing. Because where I started to say was, we have a period of years that we've been working through. Many of us here, not all of us, I know we got folks that literally come every week, new people that listen to the podcast, and that hear some of the shows on Hebrew Nation Radio and so forth that come and begin to say, as I did decades ago, hey, maybe there's more to this Bible thing than I grew up knowing. Right? A lot of us grew up in the sun god day worshiping church, and we recognized hypocrisy, and we recognized, come on, there's so many contradictions in this so-called Christianity that you're trying to sell me. We now know, because we're in the Xmas season, that if we have any understanding at all of history or economics or the Bible or even a little bit about climate in the Middle East, A, his mama never called him Jesus, and B, he weren't born in December. That didn't happen until hundreds of years later, when all of a sudden he was born in a month that he wasn't born in before, after Constantine. But that was just part of it, right? All of these contradictions that for a whole lot of folks, and it's always fun for me to talk to people who are coming out of her and recognizing that they've inherited lies from our fathers, right? Was it Sun God Day that a lot of folks learned about and decided, oh, he never changed it. It's always been Sabbath. Was it the various Moedim, the appointed times that we heard were Jewish feasts? And it turns out, no, they were the feasts of Yod Heh-Vav Heh. Well, hey, some folks never even knew that he had a real name. It wasn't the Lord, capital L-O-R-D. They took his name out. Over and over again, the prophets say, oh, they will know in that day that my name is Yahuwah, Yod Heh-Vav Heh. But they took that out too. They don't know. They think his name is the Lord, but no, that ain't it. So there's a whole lot of things. I tell people that in my case, it was three things. It was prophecy, it was marriage, and it was food. Those were the first three things that I realized I'd been lied to about. Pork is not food. What we've been told is marriage is not what it says in the Bible, for 100 different reasons. All kinds of big lies there. And finally, particularly when it came to prophecy, it was the idea of the mark of the beast, but other things as well. But I just remember thinking, wow, okay? This cannot be explained by some mere book that doesn't have divine authorship. And as I studied more, I found out there were a whole lot more things, too. So the point is, over the years, as we meet more and more people that are returning to, quote-unquote, a messianic understanding, a Hebrew roots understanding, a Torah-based understanding, a first-century Christian understanding, take your pick, pick your terminology, and people can argue about all of the various words and names. In my case, it would be, let's just understand that the law was never done away with, because it was never really the law that was the issue anyway. It was his instruction that not one yod or tittle was going to change. We don't even get the words right. Torah does not mean law. It's bigger than law. And if we don't understand the words, guess what? It's a lot easier to lie to us. It's kind of like if people don't understand sine waves or cycles. It's a lot easier to lie to them about non-existent man-made global warming because they will drink the Kool-Aid. So as people do this, for whatever reason, right, as they realize that Sabbath didn't change, never was sun god day, and that his rules about marriage didn't change, and Christmas is not when the Mashiach was born, and no, his mama never called him Jesus, and no, he didn't die so that little boys and girls could have bunnies and eggs celebrating a pagan fake deity named Easter, Ishtar, Ashtaroth, Astarte, none of that. But however we come out, we are. And it's about time. Because if you look at the economy and the fact that, dishonest weights and measures inevitably self-destruct, we're there. If you look at World War III, well, we're pretty much there. If you look at Civil War II, we're pretty much there. If you look at non-existent man-made global warming that's going to be revealed for a huge lie that's going to get a lot of people dead because they'll starve to death, before they freeze to death, in most cases, we're there. You've had years to prepare for that one. Years to prepare for the meltdown. It's been obvious since 2000. Certainly since 2008. What is that? Eight plus a little over eight. 2 decades we've had to prepare for the economic meltdown. Well, Mark, it hadn't happened yet. Well, we're headed there, right? The sine wave has been headed down slowly, and nothing that the big banksters have done has mitigated it, stopped it. No, what they've done is they've made the bubble bigger and therefore more deadly when it finally pops. So for all of these reasons, secular, physical, economic, political, and yes, scriptural reasons, people are starting to wake up. We got 100 excuses. Well, for not coming out, and 1,000 reasons to open our eyes and see that that's what we need to do. Should have started years ago. Better late than never. And as Joseph is going to point out to his brothers next week, we're at a place where, thankfully, even if it ends up, some of us have had to basically be in bondage for 22 years or so, right? So that others might live. If we have to prepare a place and make sure that we are aware, you know what? Going to be folks need a place that's warm. I remember several things that we explicitly did here on the Mesa, thinking, there'll come a time when families are going to show up and they're going to be freezing to death and they're going to say, please, can I just sleep in your barn, right? And that's like what we saw in history after history during the Great Depression and other places. Get out of the cold. Find a place to at least survive. All of these things are important, but equally important, somebody shows up and says, I'm starving, can you help me out? Well, how do we trust but verify? Seriously, this is also a matter of life and death. You let somebody into your house and they turn out to be a cannibal, or they get up in the middle of the night and they open the door for their gang, murdering rapist, zombie brethren or whatever it might be. Open your front gate and let the people come in. They kill you, eat the carcasses, take your stuff, and move on to the next farmhouse. That's not good. We certainly need to understand who we serve. All of this part is part and parcel of the problem. It's key. But even Joseph, I want to emphasize this, even Joseph, a man whom is a picture, right? A foreshadowing, if you will, of the Mashiach. You'll even hear the term, Mashiach ben Joseph, the Messiah, son of Joseph, the suffering servant. It's a picture of his first approach, first time around. He literally did a whole bunch of things, even at the time he didn't know about them, that ended up preserving life of his brothers and indeed all of the 12 tribes of Israel. The rest of the book wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for this suffering servant, Joseph. And here in this Torah portion, we're seeing a place where Joseph is beginning, I think. Now, I think he's had years to kind of get elements of this in place. I think Joseph knows. He's had those dreams, remember, long before any of this started. He has a promise that he's holding on to. Notice, too, and I've mentioned this before, Joseph, so far as we can see in Scripture, never hears the word of Yah directly. Unlike his dad and his grandfather and his great-grandfather before him, he never heard. To you I will give this land, and in your seed all of the nations of the earth will be blessed, and all of those great promises. Never heard that from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh directly. Now, I'm sure he probably heard it, dad sitting around telling the boys the stories. Probably heard it more than once, but we don't know that. Nor do we know that he didn't, but we don't see that it's written down anywhere. Joseph, in other words, hears from the Creator through dreams, and that's a big difference in his life. So here's a guy that's basically a picture of a Mashiach, and yet he's not one of the three main patriarchs that Scripture writes about. He's just one of the 12 tribes. And yet there's more ink in the Torah, in the book of Genesis in particular, about this guy than literally anybody else. Amazing. He does not seem to know the end from the beginning. He does not seem to know how this is going to work out with his brothers. He has a test and a plan, and he's working it out as he goes. And he's literally, I think, as we've seen in the story here as it unfolds, he's learning things along the way to change his plans. I think he intended to keep Reuben, but no. Heard something that they didn't know he could understand, and it ends up being Simeon instead. He intends just to hang on to Benjamin, send the rest of the boys home. I don't care. But we're going to find out, and that's not what's going to happen. And there's a lot more to the story. So, back to where we sit, too. So many wonderful lessons in here. Trust but verify. We need to be thinking about things now. Yeah, it's been very much on my mind as we look at the coming global cooling. Right? What can I do? What can I do physically here? You know, in a place where we do get below zero temperatures, but we may see colder temperatures than we've had before. I got animals to make sure we take care of. Well, they can handle pretty cold weather. How about what do we do in a winter when maybe we have nowadays, if we have a couple of days where we don't see above freezing temperatures, well, I can still get water out of above ground tanks and stuff. But that might get tough if we have weeks of really cold. And of course, if you're in an area where they never planned on having below freezing temperatures at all, and the water quits flowing because the pipes are all broken, you got a whole different problem. So all of us are going to have to deal with some things where we say, we need to understand physically what's coming. Certainly there are going to be huge economic impacts. I guarantee you food prices are going to go through the roof. Again, to the end that a lot of people will starve. How about fuel? Well, gasoline has been engineered to not last very long. 2 years tops. You got gasoline cars, if the gas quits flowing, if the ports are frozen in, if all kinds of pyramid, domino kinds of effects, breakdowns happen, well, do you have what you need long term? Okay, we are on a place here where we got lots of wonderful solar power, but it's becoming clear to me, hey, that could change, and I need to make sure we have some other alternatives. Excess capacity, if nothing else. And then again, okay, the spiritual aspect of all of this, the trust but verify part. What about when people show up? Now, ideally, one of the things we're trying to do now is to build community. I talk to folks literally every week. Hey, can we come here? Where should we go? What can we do? And all kind of stuff. I make no secret of it. We're attempting to build a community here. It's slow going because most people will talk and talk for years before they eventually decide to move or go anywhere. I understand that. Been there myself. It's tough. But on the other hand, there comes a point when the decision is made. The question is, will the decision be made in time or when it's too late? So many things like that to consider. But along the way, it is very, very important, just like when a man chooses a wife or when an employee is chosen to be a good employee or not worth hiring by somebody that has a job. Well, you have to be able to judge people, judge character, understand who are the reliable ones and who are, the wolves in sheep's clothing. testing, like Joseph finds out here, is very important. I do think if we will walk in obedience, and this is kind of the key, and do what he is telling us to do, even if we're not sure exactly how it's going to play out, but he's given us, you know, the picture, we see it through a glass darkly, that he will guide us along the way. And I think that's what's really the wonderful part about this multiple stories here, you know, with the cliffhangers in the life of Joseph. We see that there is clearly, even if it's not explicitly pointed out to us, there is clearly a divine hand at work. We can see the plan of the Creator coming through. Joseph is just an instrument of it. That's probably what makes him a wonderful picture of the Mashiach, because he's open to it. And he is at least in tune enough as things go on here that he is keeping in mind the big issues, right? Preserve life. Do what it is that I'm told to do. Walk in obedience, even if it gets me thrown in the hoosegow. All of those things are important. And he's blessed for it. And by the way, so are those people who at one point did really nasty evil to him, but at least had the good sense to feel bad about it, and more importantly, to make teshuvah, to repent, to return. And that is the real key here. So with that, what I want to do is say, do I have any other questions? I'll take a look at the screen. Because I also want to talk a bit about the Haftorah portion. And if we have time at the end, we'll probably talk a little bit about some of the other things that are in the news here, too. Whole lots going on that I think emphasizes these points. But the Haftorah for this week is from 1 Kings chapter 3. And honestly, I think this was an interesting Haftorah. As I look at it, I kind of have to admit, it's not 100% clear to me why it is that this one was picked to go here. Okay, the Haftorah officially comes from 1 Kings chapter 3, about verse 16. As soon as you look at it, if you look it up, you'll go, oh, well, I know the story. Okay, we all know the story. But what's that got to do with Joseph? Well, okay, there's at least one obvious understanding. And I'm also going to talk about the alleged Brit Chadashah portion. In other words, the part that some folks say is kind of appropriate, and I will... Well, I'll agree, simply because I'm going to suggest, yeah, it's worth talking about today. It does fit. And that's Romans chapter 10. So, here we go. The story has to do with King Solomon, right out of the chute. King Solomon's first major example, right? He's prayed for wisdom. He's told, you're going to have it in abundance. Ain't nobody going to be quite like you ever. And what does it say? Now, there were two women, right? Harlots. And they came to the king and stood before him. Everybody knows the story already, right? We got this one kid. Hers died. No, mine. Mine is the one that's the living child. Yours died. Okay? How do you prove it? Well, says Solomon, after he hears the story, go get me a sword. I'm going to cleave this little boy in half, and then we'll give each one of them half. Ah! Well, no. Actually, one of them says, sure, great. Sounds like a wonderful idea. She would be a great addition to the deep state, right? She would be just fine in Washington District of Criminals. Sounds like somebody that would be hired to serve on a campaign staff for, well, most of the newly elected Congress. Well, the newly put into office, whether they were elected or not Congress. Yeah, let's divide them all. Matter of fact, if we can kill more than that, we gotta come up with better ways than swords. Great. Well, Shlomo recognizes character, or lack thereof. The one that says, no, 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 let the boy live. Guess what? She's the real mother. Not only that, folks, I'm going to go one step further and say, if we look at today's snowflake-infested world, even if by some miracle of evil she wasn't the mother, she's still more deserving to raise the child, right? So, Shlomo he's come up with a novel solution. It demonstrates his wisdom, his understanding of human nature, and yeah, what is it? It's a test. It's a really good test. Now here you go. Now we've seen two examples of the tests that Joseph gives to identify character in people. We got this wonderful example from Solomon to identify character and who should be a mother and who is the mother and who isn't worthy even. Well, she is worthy again to be in a deep state position of power. She could probably work for she could probably be attorney general in this environment. But nothing else. And Israel, all of them, heard of the judgment which the king had rendered, and they feared the king, because they saw that the wisdom of Elohim was in him to administer justice. Great. Another wonderful example of a test. There are things here that we need to kind of take to heart and learn, because I am fully convinced that all of us are going to see similar things, and we're going to have that kind of wisdom to deal with the challenges that we're going to be presented with. So let's do this, okay? Let's turn next to the Brit Hadashah, the Apostolic Writings part. This is from Romans chapter 10. If I can find it here. There we go. And it starts like this. This is, of course, Shaul writing to the people at Rome in the time. And he says, "Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to Elohim for Israel." For Israel. What's Israel? Well, I think in this context, Shaul is talking about whole Israel, knowing that there are, in fact, because he can read Scripture, he knows the histories, there were two kingdoms, one actually called Israel. He could be talking about only the lost tribes of the north, the ten lost tribes. But I have a suspicion he's talking about whole Israel again, including the greater Israel of both King David and King Solomon that was later divided, including a lot of folks that are probably roaming around the areas that he was familiar with in the south and what would have been called Judah or Judea that weren't that obedient. Okay? So he hopes that all of them can be saved. "For I bear witness that they have a true zeal for Elohim, but..." Now this is the part that I think, whoa! This ought to resonate with us like ringing a bell. "They have a zeal for Elohim, but not according to knowledge." Does that sound like most of the whore church to you? They got a zeal for their Christmas trees and the little gold and silver ornaments, and they got a zeal for Jesus who did away with the law. Trouble is, it's a lie. But they got zeal, but it's certainly not according to knowledge. "For they," he says, "being ignorant of the righteousness," the zadikness of Elohim, "and seeking to establish their own so-called righteousness, have not submitted to the Torah obedience to the righteousness of Elohim." Now you notice I emphasized a word there. And no, I don't care what the Greek translation says. When you see the word righteousness, understand that a zadik is one who is righteous. What is the word zadik? The verbs that are associated with it, different vowel pointers, maybe. You can take that same root word that means zadik, and you can turn it into one who is a zadik. You can make it zadikim, you can make it plural, you can turn it into various other parts of speech. But the key is, in every case, we're talking about someone who understands and walks in obedience with the Torah, with the instruction of the Almighty, the Word, HaDeborim. Lots of ways to phrase it, but it's one singular concept. A zadik, righteousness, is one who walks in obedience with Torah. Not the law, the instruction, all of it. And he says it. You got all these people that claim to have a zeal for Elohim, but it's not according to knowledge. They're ignorant. Not only that, remember that line from The Simpsons, "ignorant and proud of it." Law's done away with. Well, they're liars and the truth is not in him. For crying out loud, they're calling the one that they claim to be the Mashiach a liar, saying he did away with the law, saying Paul wrote that he did away with the law. Bull! That's a polite word for it. Okay, it's worse than the stuff that comes out of the back end of a bull. It's a lie from the pit of hell. Because Yeshua himself, very first public address, everybody that's listened to me more than once knows this. Read it, Matthew 5:17. "I did not come to do away with the Torah or the prophets." No, not one yoder tittle of it, he says. Not as long as heaven and earth still exist. Same two witnesses Moshe talked about. So, to say that he did away with the law means you're a liar, or you're calling him a liar. One thing's for sure. Maybe a zeal that you have for some god, but it's not according to knowledge. Because they are ignorant of his tzaddikness, his word, and what it means to walk in obedience to it. You could not have a more clear understanding than those two verses. Okay, got a question? Oh, what chapter and verse? Romans chapter 10. Romania, the word of Yah to the Romans, chapter 10. First couple of verses 2 and 3. Okay, so here he's talking about folks, even then, that claimed to have a zeal for Elohim, but they were ignorant. They had no zeal for knowledge. They were ignorant of Elohim's righteousness and instead sought to establish their own twisted version of it, having not submitted to the righteousness of Elohim. Okay, now here's a verse that has a whole lot of problems associated with it. And A, I don't think he actually said the word Christos originally anyway. It would have been Mashiach that they're talking about. And remember, in the Greek, there's all kinds of little Christos. Tons and tons of Christos running around. And there have been lots of Christos since then. Yeshua warned against all kinds of Christos. And indeed, there were other ones that were anointed, even other anointed ones, Mashiachim. Okay? David was anointed to be king. The high priests were anointed. So lots of Mashiachim, anointed ones. But, and maybe there's even one, more than one incarnation, if you will, of the Mashiach, Ha Mashiach, with a capital Ha. Okay, you've got Mashiach ben Yosef. And we're talking about Joseph right now. And, of course, the conquering king later, Mashiach ben David. So, verse 4 is a real problem because most English has a zeal and it's ignorant of the real tzaddikness here because they don't understand. It says, because Christ is the end of the law. Well, there you go. That says it. It's done away with. Bull. Okay? The Mashiach is the goal of the entire instruction, Torah, writings, prophets. What is he? He's the Torah made flesh. It's not the end as in done away with, it's the end as in goal. The end of going to college is to get a degree and have some knowledge. Well, it used to be to get knowledge. Nowadays, it's just to get a piece of paper and to pass the tests. The end of seeking a fix for your car is to have what? A fixed car. Doesn't mean you did away with the car when you got the end of the job done. It means the car's fixed. You can use it. Okay, this is basically just really stupid misreading of a text to claim that the Christ is the end of the law. No, he's the goal of the instruction. Read the rest. Instruction in what? Oh, tzaddikness, righteousness, which means to be obedient to what? Him, the Word made flesh, the Word in general, HaDevarim. It's so clear that it's hard to imagine how it could have been twisted so horribly. But he's pointing it right out here. They're ignorant of the righteousness of Elohim. They've substituted their own. That's why they can claim it's done away with to everyone who believes. For Moses, he said, Moshe wrote about the Torah obedience, the righteousness which is of the Torah. The man who does these things shall live by them. He quotes various places in the Old Testament. That one comes from Leviticus 18. And then he asks questions. Now, you know, these are things that I will talk about frequently. They're out of what I would consider to be probably the preeminent text in the Torah that puts the lie to the claim the law is done away with. It's Deuteronomy chapter 30. All right, now we'll do this briefly because I'm going to just simply read 6 and 7. But it's important to understand what the original that Paul is quoting really says, because otherwise people will tend to what have a zeal, not according to righteousness, but according to ignorance, and ignore what the text says. Deuteronomy 30 says that, one starts out by saying, look, there'll come a time, says Moshe, when you guys are going to be scattered throughout every nation, tribe, tongue, people, all over the place, because you didn't do what? Walk in obedience. But it'll come a time then when, after Elohim has driven you out, he'll seek to regather you. That Yahuwah, your El, will bring you back from captivity. He'll have compassion, he'll gather you. Well, guess what? We're not ready for that until we begin to what? Make teshuva, return to him. Next few verses say, doesn't matter where you are. If you're driven to the farthest points under heaven, he will know, he will find you, he will gather you, he will bring you. And Yahuwah Yireh will circumcise your heart and that of your descendants, and he will allow you, what? To live. Well, there's a big connection. That's the point of what's happening with Joseph's brothers. They're going to live. It helps that they're going to repent and return, well, to right relationship with their brother and with the Creator. And Yahuwah, it says, is going to put all these curses on your enemies, those who hated you and persecuted you. And you will again obey the voice of Elohim. Actually, it's Yahuwah there, the capital L-O-R-D, so we know that if we fix what King James messed up and all the other English translations, well, not all of them, there's more and more that put it back. It's Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh there, the Tetragrammaton. So it says here, now listen to this, and you will again obey the voice of Yahuwah and do what? The ones that haven't been done away with, except for Christmas and Easter and Sunday and a few other things we don't like? No, all of the commandments which I command you today. And then all this good stuff will happen. If you obey the voice of Yahuwah, your El, to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the Torah, and if you turn to him with all your heart and with all your soul. This is a regathering. Has not ever happened yet in all of human history. You got a whole bunch of ignorant liars, ignorant of Elohim's righteousness, seeking to establish their own, that are saying, oh, we don't have to do that. Law is done away with. What an incredible lie from the pit of hell. You know, I usually say there are two lies in Genesis, right? The two big lies for all time. You can be like God, you will not die. There's a worse one. The law's done away with. Kind of puts those others to shame. Well, actually, it's exactly the inevitable result. You can be like God. You can say the law is done away with. You will not die. The hell you won't. The hell you won't. You want to be regathered? He tells us how it's going to happen. He says, will happen. You will again obey the voice of Yahuwah and do all of his commandments. You'll abound in all this good stuff. If what? You will obey the voice of Yahuwah, Eloheka, to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the Torah, which is not done away with. Anybody tells you his instruction is done away with is a liar. The truth is not in them. They're replacing his righteousness with theirs. Because we got better stuff today. We know better than the God of the Bible ever did. What a lie from the pit of hell. Okay, and here he quotes those verses that I am getting ready to head to. Now, the thing that's important here, of course, is unless you read in context this chapter and see that the guy who wrote this book here and given this speech, Moshe, is telling folks all this stuff's going to come to pass. You're going to return. There'll come a time. This will happen. If you obey, if you return with all your heart and all your soul, and if you keep his judgments, his statutes that are written in this book of the Torah. Pretty straightforward, pretty simple. Here's the part Paul quotes. Now, Paul, I think, is basically saying, hey, everybody knows this, right? Well, they did. They don't anymore. The people that he was writing to actually had a better understanding than most dumbed down Sunday Christmas and Ishtar keeping Christians who never bothered to read what it says. There's a line from the Music Man I love. It's a quote. It's out of context here, but it fits. And it's the mother of Marion the Librarian talking about a book, and she says, "Forgive me for living, but I never read it." That applies to so many Christians and the old done away with Testament. In Deuteronomy chapter 30, and they'll read what it says here in Romans chapter 10, they'll take it so hideously out of context that they can use it to justify exactly what he just warned about. Being ignorant of the righteousness of Elohim and seeking to establish their own in its place. Or at least what they've been told by the whores, the priests, the potentates of religiosity and the 501c3 tax-exempt Caesar-created state-chartered whore church of another god. Ready? This is what it says, the choice of life or death. For this commandment, continues Moshe, right, the one he says you better keep, that you will keep at some point when the time is here for the regathering. For this commandment which I command you today, it's not too hard for you, it's not too mysterious for you, it's not too far off. It's not up in heaven that you need to say, who'll go up there and bring it to us? It's not down over the other side of the sea that you say, who goes over there and gets it to us? It is very near to you, should be at least, was at one time, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it. Here comes what I refer to sometimes as the open book test. Whole point of the book. See, I have set before you this day life and good, death and evil. In that I command you today to love Yahuwah Eloheka, to walk in His ways, to keep His commandments, His statutes, and His judgments, that you may live and multiply, and that not only do you go into the land which you are going to possess and are blessed, but hey, some point in the far distant future, you might even be able to return after having been kicked out for cause. He goes on to say, look, if you don't do this, you will surely perish. And here's Paul. Okay, he's going to quote exactly those verses. Not all of them. He's going to assume probably that you could read them for yourself. That is, if you haven't been dumbed down too much by the whore church. Moshe, he says, writes about this kind of righteousness, this zodicness, which is of the Torah. The man who does these things shall live by them. There you go. But the righteousness of faith, he says, in other words, the Torah, of those who walk in obedience and understand what that really means, righteous-wise, says this, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven, or who will ascend into the abyss. It says the word is near you. It's in your heart and in your mind, and you may do it. That, he says, is the word of faith which we preach. Well, of course it is. If it wasn't, he'd be a liar, and the truth is not in him. And then he goes on to say, if you confess with your mouth that in fact he came in the flesh, you know I don't like a translation here which gets the name wrong because people say, oh, well, that's the Jesus did away with the law he's talking about, right? No, it's not. Let's not confuse ourselves. The point of the lie is to confuse people. If you are confessing that the guy who did away with the law is your Savior, you got a problem. Whoever it is that we ought to be talking about was, in fact, the Torah made flesh. It was that one. His mama never called him Jesus. Now, I don't have a problem with the name per se. As you know, I have a problem with those who claim that that name is the one that did away with the law, so you don't have to do it anymore. Because exactly what Paul is saying, and Moshe before him, is that's a lie. And by the way, so, of course, did Yahushua. He said he wasn't going to change the tiniest bit of it. Not any of it. So how could we be claiming that if you confess Jesus did away with the law, you expect to get anything? For with the heart one believes unto righteousness. Unto what? Torah obedience. And with the mouth confession is made unto salvation. Who saves? Yahu saves. Yahushua. That's what the name as given means. It's real simple. It's just that it's been made complicated by liars who have literally, you talk about blasphemy against the Ruach? There you go, folks. Calling the one that they claim to be the Savior a liar and saying he did that which he said he wasn't going to do. Wow. For the scripture says, whoever believes on him will not be put to shame, or actually to haste there. He goes on to say something which has also been pretty well twisted and is a problem, but if we understand two houses, northern kingdom, southern kingdom, and some of the things that we've also been lied to about, in other words, you got the rabbinic Judaism, which says there is no Mashiach, certainly not the one that, well, I can't blame them, I guess, for thinking that one who did away with the law couldn't be the Mashiach. And then you've got the Roman pagan house, the whoring house, that says, oh, see, we've got a better God, and we've got all of our idols and other things that he said not to do. We'll mix all of this stuff that he said not to mix. It's the very same reason why we haven't been regathered yet, and why you've got a whoring house of the south and a whoring house of the north that are still largely in exile. Verse 12, though, in context, if we understand it, says this. Now, I'll read the English, and then we'll try to make sure we understand it. There is no distinction, he says, between Jew and Greek, for the same L-O-R-D over all is rich to all who call upon him. For whoever, and here he quotes, what? Joel, chapter 2. For whoever calls on the name of Yahuwah shall be saved. Think of it. What does the verse in Joel say? For whoever calls upon the name of Yahuwah is chewed. It's right there. But we twist it all around. How can they call on him whom they have not believed, he asks. Think about that in context. Now, we've just talked about no difference between the Jew and the Greek. Well, the Greek is another word for what? The goyim, the nations, those who don't know who they are. In other words, a whole lot of people that would arguably be scattered amongst these nations, tribes, peoples, the lost tribes, all of whom, if they return, can be grafted in, because all are spiritual heirs of Abraham, able to be grafted in to that root and the branch that springs from. Whoever calls upon the name of Yahuwah shall be saved. How can they call on him in whom they have not believed? Now think about it. They call on Jesus, who they've been told did away with the law, did away with all the Moedim, his special appointed times, that are not Jewish, but they are Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh's. He says, keep them forever. They say, nope, don't keep them at all, or we'll kill you. And indeed, for centuries they did. He said, keep my Sabbath. They said, no, we got better ones today. We'll change them to the sun god day. Changing times and seasons. Hey, all the prophets, Daniel, others, warned about doing that. Deuteronomy says, don't add to or subtract from. Doing all of that. How can they call on him whom they have not believed? You have a bunch of people who understand the Torah, rabbinic Jews, that say, well, we can't possibly believe in a Messiah who did away with the law. Why? Because they can read. They can read Deuteronomy 7, Deuteronomy 12, Deuteronomy 13. You can't believe in a so-called Mashiach who did away with the law, because he's a liar and the truth is not in him. I can't blame him. The trouble is, that's not what the real Yeshua ever said. He said the opposite. How about the ones who say, he did away with the law. We believe in Jesus. Law's nailed to the cross. I can have a pork sandwich to celebrate my freedom in Christ. And if it kills me, hey, I get to go to wherever I'm going a bit sooner. That kind of zodicness, folks, righteousness, is of one place. And guess what? It's not of him. It's not of the Torah. Any doubts? Read Acts chapter 10. Peter, Kepha, years after Yeshua, says, hey, we ain't never had a pork sandwich in our lives. He knows better. You'd have thought that if the Mashiach was going to do away with the law and start saying, have a pork sandwich on me, that he'd have told Peter. But he didn't. This is not complicated stuff. This is the kind of stuff that, again, I think more and more people who are coming out of the whore church are saying, yeah, I mean, it don't make sense. It's self-contradictory. So if we read Romans from the context of a man who was Torah observant his entire life and who finally came to understand, look, there's a whole lot of crap. This is Paul. I'm paraphrasing a whole lot of his stuff, Galatians and other places. A whole lot of stuff I was told was the law wasn't the law at all. It was men making it up. Read Mark chapter 7. Read Matthew chapter 23. Yeshua nailed them. He said, look, you hypocrites, you claim this is the law, all your traditions. By your traditions, you've made the commandments of Yah of no effect. You're hypocrites, liars. Paul got it. The whore church is still lying about it. How can they call on him whom they've not believed? You got a whole bunch of whores in two houses denying him and his word and what he did. No wonder we're still in exile and there's so many people still walking in bondage and in ignorance and seeking to establish their own righteousness. How can they preach, he continues, unless they're sent? How can they believe in him whom they've not heard? How can they hear without a preacher? Well, folks, that is up to us. to make sure we understand what's really written as opposed to what men say he should have written if he was half as smart as they are. How can they preach unless they're sent? As it's written. How beautiful to the feet of those who preach the gospel of shalom, who bring glad tidings of good things. Let's make sure they're true things, too. But he says they have not all observed the Besorah, the good news, the gospel, the word. Hadevarim. For the prophet Isaiah, Yeshe Yahu. Isn't it cool if you think about what the meanings of these names are? Yahuwah, who has believed our report? A lot of these are going to come from the later chapters of Yeshayahu, Isaiah. And we're working up to the ones that I'm going to spend more time on in a second here. Now, this line I like. Paul says, Shaul writes, so then, understand this, faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of Yah. This is part of the reason why, years ago, I think it's important for a husband, right, to wash his wives, his children, all of those in his house, wash them by the water of the word. And it's important to read it. I think all of us, we do better when we hear it. There's something about the way our brains work that we seem to get a different kind of a look at it when we hear it than when we just read it for ourselves. Part of the reason why I like these sessions and why I try to go on Friday nights through the entire Torah portion and talk about these things, and indeed, either paraphrase or read large sections of the stories, or sometimes we'll talk about the words specifically and what they mean. It's all about hearing, because faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of Yah. You think maybe that might have something to do with why the word was made flesh and dwelt among us, tabernacled among us? He spoke it. He spoke the world into existence, and he came and he spoke it to us. And it was written down, and since then it's been twisted. But we can still go back and literally hear it, if we will but open our ears, open our eyes, and understand. Faith comes by hearing, hearing by the word of Yah. But, says Paul, I say, have they not heard? Yes, indeed. Their sound has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. Psalm 19. But I say, did Israel not know? Kol Israel? All 12 tribes? The mixed multitude even. First Moshe says, I'll provoke you to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move you to anger by a foolish nation. This is Deuteronomy 32. This is coming up just shortly after the part we just read. What's the context? Moshe's talking about a time when there'll be this regathering. This is his literally his final admonition to Kol Israel. He knows what's fixing to happen. You know, in another chapter or so, he's going to walk up on the mountain, that's it. He's going to leave them with his words of wisdom. Hey, here's what's going to happen. Y'all need to understand, you're going to go into the land, great, and then you're going to be kicked out of the land, not so great, and eventually you'll come back, great. But here's what's going to happen first, and that's where we are today. I'll move you to anger by a foolish nation, provoke you to jealousy by those who are not a nation. But Isaiah, he says, is pretty bold, he says the following. Now, by the way, I'm going to read this first. This comes from Isaiah chapters 65. Now, 65 and 66 are the last two chapters of Isaiah. Some of you know that's some of my favorite stuff on Isaiah, because I really contend this is stuff that tells us what's happening today in so many ways. All right, Isaiah was very bold. He says the following. I'm going to read it literally from Isaiah 65 verses 1 and 2. Because this is what he's going to lay out. He says the following, and then he says this to Israel. So here we go. Isaiah, Yeshayahu, the salvation of Yah, chapter 65. I was sought by those who did not ask for me. I was found by those who did not seek me. Hineni, hineni, says, here I am, here I am. To a nation that was not called by my name. Let's pause. Right there. A nation that was not called by my name. Could that be America with a K? Not yet. Because they haven't found anything. They haven't sought most of them, for much of anything. They're sure as hell not called by his name. They don't even know his real name. They don't know anything about him. They think he's somebody different than they've been told. Born in Natasuka, a manger. When? At a time when there weren't any shepherds out watching over their flocks. Did something that he said he wasn't going to do. All that stuff. How can they preach here? Learn Zadikness from a lie. They don't. A nation that was not called by my name. Okay, I'm not going to say that I know what that nation is, but I'm going to suggest there are a whole lot of candidates for it. Pick a globe, spin it, put your finger down. Probably some nation that's not called by his name that your finger lies on. Odds are, it's a big one. You know, just based on landmass, and America is certainly one of those. No doubt about it, not called by his name. I stretched out my hand all day long, he says, to a rebellious people who walk in a way that is not good, according to their own thoughts. And they provoke me to anger continually, rubbing it in my face. Right to my face, he says. Ah, gee, I'll ask it again. Could that be America? There's nothing I can see in the news that says it's not. On the other hand, could it be Britain? Could it be France? Where they got riots today? Could it be any number of other Western nations? You betcha. Tons of candidates. Rebellious people who walk in a way that's not good according to their own thoughts and provoke him to anger continually. You know, if I had to pick a place in the United States outside the swamp, might be Hollywood. Plenty of candidates where it's really, really obvious, in other words. They sacrifice in gardens. They burn incense on altars of brick, sit among the graves, spend the night in tombs, eat swine's flesh and the broth of abominable things in their vessels. Gee, it just keeps getting worse and more clear, doesn't it? They say to yourself, keep to yourself, don't come near me, for I am holier than thou. Whoa, we got the Oscars coming up. They're going to tell you that all night long. I am holier than thou. I know better than you. I will tax you. I will take your stuff. You're not fit to have a jet and a limousine and a mansion on the beaches at Malibu. I'm holier than thou. Wow. Or if you're Al Gore, you can have lots of mansions. You can burn fossil fuel to keep them warm or cool. I'm holier than thou. I know better because what? I am entitled to speech. You're not. I'm entitled to run a $1 billion company and take away your rights. I'm entitled to guns and you're not. I'm entitled to be free of illegal search and seizure, and you're not. Think about the news, folks. Almost everything in the news says there are two kinds of people. Those who are above the law, right, Hitler-y, Mueller, Comey, you name it. And those who can't do the law, even if their lives depended on it, because they aren't up to snuff. They're not as holy. Why? Well, some of them still believe they're bitter clingers, says Bathhouse Barry. They cling to their God, their guns, their gold, and their Bibles. They're not fit. They're not as good as us. They don't deserve equal protection under the law. Whew. Don't come near me. I'm holier than that. They, he says, are smoke in my nostrils, a fire that burns all the day. Behold, it's written before me. I will not keep silence, but will repay, even repay into their bosom, your iniquities and the iniquities of your fathers together, says Yahuwah. They burned incense on the mountains, blasphemed me on the hills. Hollywood Hills? A lot of hills. Therefore, I will measure their former work into their bosom. Thus says Yahuwah, as the new wine is found in the cluster, and one says, do not destroy it, for a blessing is in it, so will I do for my servant's sake, that I might not destroy them all. I will bring forth descendants from Yaakov. Oh, yeah, those 12 tribes, many of whom still don't know who they are, still scattered, still roaming around, having no idea that they're, you know, going after all kinds of fake gods, including fake Jesuses, little Christos. They're kind of like Joseph's brothers, come to think of it, aren't they? Don't know yet. They're starting to sense that something's wrong. Maybe they deserve what's getting ready to happen to them. Just maybe, if they'll continue trying to learn their lessons, fess up, return, walk in obedience, maybe there's a blessing in there. Now, let me pause again. I am suggesting, have suggested for a long time, that this slope that we're talking about has been decreasing. Or actually, the rate of change is increasing, kind of like as a snowball goes downhill, it picks up speed, right? At the zero cross, you get the maximum velocity. That's the maximum rate of change. We're there. We're close, at least. And this downhill slope, economically, physically, climate-wise, spiritually, you name it. There's a blessing in here. Let's read what he says again. As a new wine is found in the cluster, don't destroy it. There's a blessing in it. So will I do for my servant's sake, he says, that I might not destroy them all. Are folks going to suffer in what's coming? You betcha. There will be war. There will be meltdown. There will be cold. There will be famine. There was famine in Egypt. There are going to be a lot of people die. We shouldn't keep silent either, of course. He will not, for his servant's sakes, he says, destroy all of us. I will bring forth descendants from Yaakov and from Judah, an heir to my mountains. Notice that? Two references. Almost like he's talking about two houses, right? The majority that lost 10 tribes of Israel and of Judah. My elect, he says, shall inherit it. My servants shall dwell there. Sharon shall be a fold of flocks, the valley of Achor, a place for the herds to lie down, and my people who have sought me. But you, now he's talking to some other folks, it sounds like, are those who forsake Yahuwah. Not the Lord, folks. Yod Heh Vav Heh, the one that wrote the book. Let's not confuse a whole lot of terminology that's gotten a lot of people killed and is going to end up killing a whole bunch more if we don't get it right. You are those who forsake Yahuwah, who forget my holy mountain and prepare a table for Gad, furnish a drink offering for Mani, some pagan deity. I don't know, could you say Baal, maybe Easter, or Ishtar, or Jove, or the Yule? Lots and lots of potential pagan deities. Hey, hell, most of them have been ingratiated into the Roman pagan church and celebrated. It's a time to be really aware of some of that. Therefore, I will number you for the sword, and you shall all bow down to the slaughter. Because when I called, you did not answer. When I spoke, you did not hear, but you did evil before my eyes. Bring those Christmas trees on in. Mark, are you really suggesting that, Mark? I'm suggesting the Bible is real clear. Do not bring an abomination into your house. Men who would like to be part of Israel. You bring the abomination into your house, bring that Christmas tree in, sit around it and worship it. Bible says don't bring it in. Yahushua says, I'm not changing one word of that. Didn't I warn you before? Do not bring an abomination into your house. Don't even covet the gold or silver that's on them. How can people reconcile rebellion and say, oh, but I will have peace. I will have safety. I'll rub his nose in what I'm doing. He had better like my righteousness. I've ignored his. I don't like it, so I won't read it. But I'll bring that pagan crap into my house. I'll celebrate. You shall bow down to the slaughter. He says, I'll number you for the sword. Because when I called, you didn't answer. When I spoke, you did not hear. But you did evil before mine eyes, and you chose that in which I do not delight. I guess you could have a ham sandwich in front of the Christmas tree, too. And then say, oh, God, protect me from the, plagues that might just be coming as the mini ice age descends on us and food is scarce. Do we want to be numbered for the sword, or would we rather be among those who, for my servant's sake, are not all destroyed? I don't see there's that much doubt about this. And remember, Shaul was quoting Deuteronomy 30. I have laid before you life and blessing, or death and cursing. Pick. It ain't hard. It's not over here. It's not over there. It's not up in heavens. It's not across the sea that you can say, no, nobody told me this. It was too hard. He even says, it's not too hard for you. There has never been a more clear understanding than Scripture has provided for us for centuries, but never a more clear choice as we look ahead and see where we are at this point of maximum change right now, that these things are coming to pass. Therefore it says, thus says Yahuwah Elohecha, behold, my servants shall eat, but you shall be hungry. Behold, my servants shall drink, but you shall be thirsty. Behold, my servants shall rejoice, but you shall be ashamed. Behold, my servants shall sing for joy of heart, but you'll cry for sorrow of heart and wail for grief of spirit. You shall leave your name as a curse to my chosen. For Yahuwah Eloheka will slay you and call his servants by another name, so that he who blesses himself in the earth shall bless himself in the Elohim of truth. And he who swears in the earth shall swear by the Elohim of truth, because the former troubles are forgotten, because they are hidden from my eyes. Behold, I create new heavens and a new earth. Former shall not be remembered or come to mind, but be glad and rejoice for whatever, forever, in what I create. For behold, I create Yerushalayim as a rejoicing, and her people a joy. I'll rejoice in Jerusalem and joy in my people. The voice of weeping shall no longer be heard in her, nor the voice of crying. Now he continues, and it talks about a whole bunch of really good stuff. But I'll suggest, just as we'll look next week at the good stuff to come, the story of Joseph, right, has definitely come to a middle. The story of the test has come to a middle. We're going to see how Judah had better man up. We're going to see how the rest of the brothers had better get with the program. And here we have Isaiah 65. Remember, the last chapter is 66, where he's going to even offer a more stern warning, but it has a lot of repetition in it. And here we are. So let's begin to pause and wrap up at this point. We are at a point of maximum change, climate-wise, economy-wise, spiritually. I mean, seriously, folks, how much more lying can people have crammed down their throats and not either vomit or drink the Kool-Aid? Wasn't too long ago we had that metaphor. Yeah, drink the Kool-Aid came from Jonestown. What's Jonestown? Jonestown is a leftist paradise. Jim Jones, where did he come from? San Francisco, land of cesspools, needles, and caca in the streets. Jim Jones had a lot to do with bringing that about. San Francisco has taken it to the logical conclusion. So has Venezuela. And if the Big Brother types have their way, they intend to do that via the cesspools in D.C. to the entire stinking, fetid, what's left of America with a K. And all you got to do is read Isaiah 65 and go, yeah, talk about provoking me to anger continually to my face. And that sounds like what the Creator is pointing out to us. And again, it's not just the United States. You can look at Britain. You can look at France. The good news, I guess, and maybe we'll come back to this a little bit later on if we have some time. People in France are saying, we've had it. With political correctness, we've had it with taxes for non-existent man-made global warming. Maybe they're starting to say, hey, you know, how can there be warming when we're freezing? And they've had it with the Islamic invasion of people who, worship a different God and have a whole different set of law than the Torah, but they don't even like French wines and bread. And the French have had it with that. I think they mispronounce the language, too, for whatever reasons, but they don't want to learn the language. The French are starting to get it. And by the way, so are even the Swedes and several other places as this yellow vest thing spreads. So we're at maximum change because a lot of people are waking up. No, many of them, most of them, without question, have not yet returned. I think that's going to be a ways out. I think a whole lot of people got to starve before they finally figure out, he says, my servants shall eat. These others are going to be hungry. I think I'd like to be among his servants. Well, they're not ready yet. Our job is to prepare a place to speak the truth boldly, to be ready in whatever it takes us, like Joseph was, to follow through on what's coming. Okay, so with that, any other questions, comments? I see the comment about Lev, heart, yeah, and the question, of course, is where is our heart? What does the heart mean? It's the organ that pumps blood. Life is in the blood. So the metaphor is complete. But over the centuries, you'll find that other cultures thought of the center of our thought processes and what it is that constitutes the us, the I, the id, the nefesh, the neshama, you know, as where does that reside, or does it reside in a human body at all, so forth. But that word there, yeah, lev, levavi, levim, hearts, heart. Okay, don't see any other questions, so we'll pause there. Let's see. I'll take a quick peek at the news. I don't know if there's anything I need to go through. I already kind of alluded to the one that I think was interesting in terms of this maximum rate of change thing. If you didn't hear it, Paris on lockdown. Tear gas, water cannons fired at yellow vest rioters. 700 arrests. Protests are now spreading across Europe to Brussels and Amsterdam. No less than five nations have had enough. It's time to bring out our inner Vikings, says some people from Sweden. They're protesting against what? Mass immigration and invasion outside the Swedish parliament. This was last week. This week, the Yellow Vest movement has spread into Sweden too, along with Belgium, the Netherlands, and Germany, where they've decided that the fascist heir to Adolf, Angela Merkel, is not on their team, and others. So, you know, you have to look at that and go, well, like so many things, in France, of course, they had a problem. The Americans had the American Revolution because we knew that our rights come from God. In France, no, it was liberté, égalité, fraternité, and they decided guillotine was the way that they were going to enforce that, and God had nothing to do with it, and the difference in the two histories is clear over the years. Oh, what's the significance of the yellow vest? The protesters in Europe are wearing these yellow vests. It's a great symbol, if you will, of being called a yellow vest person. So people just put on the yellow vest, then they recognize them. You're a protester. You don't like, you know, the socialist Macron and the invasion of the Islamics, and you don't like paying higher fuel taxes so that you can't drive, so that, you know, you can freeze instead. So the yellow vests are a kind of a popular expression of that discontent. Now, the reason why you have yellow vests is because a lot of these socialist nations have required, and I didn't realize this until later, by the way, in most of the press coverage, you're not going to hear about the real issues and the yellow vests. But it turns out that whoever came up with the yellow vest was kind of clever. Any car in most of Europe has to have a yellow vest in it, right? I've got somebody that maybe can comment on it. I don't know whether Czech Republic does or not. But certainly France did, and some of the other nations too. So they got these yellow vests in their trunk of their car, because if you have an accident or you have a flat tire or you run out of gas or whatever, you're supposed to put on this yellow vest, and then it's an emergency indicator, yeah, that there's a roadside issue. So the cops see the yellow vest, and they can come and help, or they can come and rob you, whatever it is. But what was, you know, last week, remember, the big news was the cops were basically saying, hey, we're on your team, yellow vest wearers in France. And now you got other issues, of course, where people are coming in and they're rioting, and as is so often the case with human nature, what may have started for reasons of people that have had enough and don't like it, there are those that are going to join in and say, hey, this is a great chance to break into my local French boutique and steal whatever I want, you know. So there's always that. Here's a great article from Natural News, J.D. Hayes. Humanity is revolting, he says, against the globalist plot to alter the atmosphere in the name of fighting climate change. And again, the point is that most of the world's press, especially here in the United States, is not covering the real issue. Yes, they don't like paying these higher taxes for fuel. They're already paying what we would call ridiculously high fuel prices and tax rates in most of Europe anyway. What they have decided they don't like is paying these high taxes to support something they have come to realize is bogus. And there's not just that. Of course, there's the migration, the invasion issues. Here's one from France. Marine Le Pen, right? She is one of the Trumps of Europe, has called the signing of the UN Migration Pact by France an act of betrayal of France. And she's right. And it turns out there's things like that all over the place. The plot to destroy the Earth in order to save it. Another story that's out there. again, the thing that I think is most interesting about this is even if most Americans are being lied to about it, still being lied to about climate change, a whole lot of people in Europe are they're seeing that we've been lied to even worse than those stupid Americans have. We've got Islamic invasion up our yin yang, and our wives and daughters are getting raped, and we've already been pre-disarmed to make it easier, and we're already not able to afford fill in the blank, and they want to make it worse, and we've had it. So great. There's this. This one's one that I wanted to make sure I mentioned because it's not too far from here. It's a place that once upon a time, my house actually lived, so I'm familiar, very familiar with the People's Republic of Boulder, Colorado. As you probably know, I remember mentioning it, in May of this year, the leftist nutcases at the helm of the Boulder City Council, I mean, you have not run into a worse bunch of vapid snowflake cretins than the Boulder City Council. In May, in a fit of righteous do-goodism, says the New American coverage, the city of Boulder unanimously banned the sale or possession nocturne of what they call assault weapons, along with magazines that they don't want you to have, or bump stocks. So, trouble is, once upon a time, Boulder was out west. Once upon a time, in a city of about 100,000, there were about 100,000 people who knew what the right to keep and bear arms meant. Now, some of them went over the top in that case. They got elected to city council. But among the city's residents are about 100,000 who already own firearms. Now, in order to get this to slide down ever so smoothly, the city said, well, we're going to grandfather these weapons in. You communists who live in Boulder and haven't yet gotten the word, you get to keep them. That is, provided you are good little communists. You must register them, of course. And trust us, have we ever lied to you before? Would we take them away from you? No, no, don't worry your pretty little snowflake heads about that. All you have to do is by December 27th, that's 2 weeks hence, you have to register your firearm. You have to certify it with the local PD and, of course, pay the fee so you can keep what you thought, ha-ha, silly communist you thought was your property. And, of course, we're going to run a background check and see if we still want to allow you. We'll check your social media. We'll see if you might have a MAGA hat in the closet or whatever. Okay. And if you're cleared, and if we say it's okay, then, and your check clears the bank, that's important, then you get to keep what you thought you owned. You get a certificate of ownership. No, not just one. Hey, we're making a two-for-one sale. You get two of them. It shows the particulars of the firearm, the serial number, the date that it was actually registered. One is to be kept with the firearm. If we catch you with the firearm, you don't have the certificate, we will, of course, steal our property. The other you keep somewhere safe, just in case you lose the one, so that we don't come and steal it from you later. Now, the council promised have we ever lied to you? We're not going to keep records. Trust us. And it's going to be voluntary. Well, kind of voluntary. It's voluntary, of course, at gunpoint. Boulder City Attorney Tom Carr has said, anyone found Octun fit a non-certified firearm in his possession after December 27th would be subject to a fine of $1,000 and 90 days in jail. Now, I think you can rape somebody on the streets in Boulder and have a less severe sentence than that. That shouldn't surprise us. You can certainly, you can do almost anything on the streets of Boulder, folks. And I tell you, as one who's been there, you can have a Satan class. Put it up on the mall. You can't have a class basically worshiping the God of the Bible, I don't think. They may come and persecute you. Boy, having been in Boulder and literally having seen what's happened to the People's Republic of Boulder, nothing surprises me anymore. It is virtually Satan Central in Colorado, right? I'm looking around the room here. Anyway, so the city attorney says, Octung, you got one of these things that's not properly registered. We will steal it. You will pay $1,000. You will go to jail. The now illegal firearm will be confiscated and destroyed. Stolen is the better word, right? It's not your property. It was, But the city council, in its communist majesty, has decreed you slaves don't have rights to property anymore. We'll take it away. You can beg for it, pay a fee, and maybe keep it. But if you don't have the paperwork, we'll steal it anyway. And if we change our minds later, hey, we know where you live. Question? This is Boulder City. Yes. Of course, but they don't care. Because they don't read it. And shall not be infringed, well, doesn't mean what it used to mean. So the question was, two questions. One, was this city of Boulder or county of Boulder? Some of you know, I use the name, pen name of Mark Niwot, because once upon a time, when I first started doing radio, we lived in Niwot, Colorado, which is, in fact, in what was then, not so much anymore, rural Boulder County. Outside the city limits of Boulder, where my tagline, as I used to introduce my radio program, was, from outside the city limits of Boulder, on a clear day, you can still see reality. Not so much anymore. And the county of Boulder is almost as left-leaning as the city, and the city of Longmont has gotten not much better. That's also in Boulder County, and part of one of many reasons why we ain't there no more. So, here's the funny part. This is the thing I've been working up to. It's not bad enough. All of this stuff is in the piece here. The city attorney questioned just how many citizens, slaves, serfs, in the People's Republic of Boulder would comply with their new Octoon demand. Quote, here's what he said. He actually admitted this. This is a very divisive issue where people have strong feelings. Yeah, like if you come and try to steal my stuff, I may just put a bullet between your eyes. You criminal, you. And I hope, folks, I'm serious, I hope people will realize there comes a point, the founders would have probably gone to battle long before now, when if they come to kill you, you'd better be able to defend yourself. And they intend to kill you. And they intend to disarm you first and then kill you later, but they're happy, as we just had one California so-called elected representative say, to kill you if they have to sooner rather than later, because they intend to take your guns. And they intend to do thereafter anything they want to. And as he put it, we have nukes, and we'll use them. And the city of Boulder doesn't have nukes, but they got people who are willing to use whatever force is necessary in order to mandate their idiotology. Back to this so-called city attorney. Yep, people have strong feelings. The folks, he said, who oppose these kind of bans, some of them suggest they're not going to cooperate. No, some of them have suggested if you try, they will, in fact, use those weapons for the very purpose that the founders said, the right to keep them shall not be infringed. Said the city attorney, continuing, I can't predict what people are going to do, but. Okay, here I'll quote a fellow that I have met before and lived in the People's Republic, John Caldera. He's the president of a free market think tank called the Independence Institute. John's a good guy. We've had lots and lots of mutual friends running the same circles. He is a well-known activist. He's a libertarian, prominent in the city of Boulder and in Denver. And he published a letter of defiance in the Denver Compost back in May, said the following. My hometown of Boulder is about to define me as a criminal if I do not disarm or move. Let this column serve as a public notice. I will not comply. Unquote. Okay. May Yah bless and keep him and Ari and Bob and any number of other folks that we all know who are good people who are going to fight this. And I mean fight it. And I could probably sit down and name 50 people, folks, in the city and county of Boulder who are basically not going to register their protection against the communists that now run, well, indeed, that entire front range. Ready for this? As of December 1st, the Boulder Sick Police Department had certified out of who knows how many tens of thousands and 100,000 firearms in Boulder, had certified 85. 85. That's less than 1%, and it's probably less than 1% of 1%. So the good news is, even in the People's Republic, people have seen it and they've had it. They're waking up in Europe. You know, more and more are begging Big Brother, oh, pretty please, can I defend myself against the Islamic hordes that you're importing? Well, of course, they're going to make it difficult. Boulder is going to say, no, we got to pre-disarm you so that we can make sure that when we do exactly what California is already doing and what Minnesota has perfected and what we intend to do, you can't defend yourself. All right. Beware the deep state distraction in the weeks to come. This is from James Howard Kunstler about the battle that is looming at the federal level. And I've said it. I'm going to think it and say it more bluntly than ever. Literally, this is a battle to the death. Now, I don't know if Trump is truly a sellout. One of the big Fox guys, Tucker Carlson, is saying he's had it. Trump has failed to deliver. I don't know. Trump certainly has been undermined, and I admire at least what looks like a pretty good fight up until this point. Has he caved? Has he given in? Not sure. Do they intend to kill him if he won't? If he is in fact who he seems to be, would they kill him if they can? Absolutely, I have no doubt about it. We've got less than a month before not so duly elected bunch of communists goes to Congress and says, "The hell with the rule of law," and that's about as kind as I can put it. Will we see a perp walk before then? I increasingly doubt it. But I have no doubt that there really is a battle coming, and this is a battle to the death. By early part of next year, most Americans that have eyes to see and ears to hear will know whether there really still is a rule of law in America with a K, or whether it literally is dead, stick a fork in it. Here is one example of how far things have gone. Actually, two. Stephen Cohen via The Nation, which is kind of a leftist rag. War with Russia, he asks. The new Cold War is more dangerous than the one the world already survived. Well, see, there are leftists thinking, hey, you know what? Back in the Vietnam era, some of us good leftists thought that war was bad. Why are we hanging with those people who are saying, no, it's good. Kill anybody with a MAGA hat. Kill anybody that's white, male, cisgendered, or anything else we, you know, add to the list later. Kill anybody that has a gun that we don't want them to have, or speaks what we don't want them to speak. So some of them are waking up. There are, in other words, a lot of honest, true liberals that are saying, and I'm looking at people like some of the high-profile constitutional lawyers, Alan Dershowitz, who has been pretty blunt at saying, hey, you know, what they're doing to Trump is absolutely unconstitutional. And the left needs to recognize that and admit it. Which brings me to this piece. This is the one that I think is almost funny, and it kind of shows a little bit of what we're seeing in Europe. It's written by T.A. Frank, comes from Vanity Fair. Now, I didn't see it on Vanity Fair because I don't read that particular rag, but it was, in fact, posted by Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge, and it's called, Is This It? A Trump Hater's Guide to Mueller Skepticism. And basically, he says the following. You know, if you look at this criminal, he doesn't say it, but I will, Mueller, his comportment suggests a man who's fallen prey to the same state of mind that warped Ken Starr. Namely, disgust over the people you're investigating and the desire to justify all the time you've already wasted, the sunk capital. So even, he says, if the special counsel eventually, don't hold your breath, presents one hell of a report, honest Democrats have to ask, was it worth it? And, you know, he goes on to say, look, for many, the air is electric. Look and see all the big names. But the point is, there's really no evidence. These people really aren't guilty of any crimes that had anything to do with the special counsel's mandate. Quote, we see the familiar cycle of hype. There's no use fighting it. But once heart rates have slowed, the same old question remains. So what? Right? There's no there. There's no pony in that barn full of you-know-what. Mueller keeps telling you there's a pony in there. He's been lying all along. Certainly, he says, Trump's ethical standards may not meet ours. Hey, we're holier than thou. But, he says, correctly, if sleaziness were a crime, then many more people from our ruling class would be in jail. Well, if treason were a crime, I can think of about a half a dozen people who would be in jail and not prosecuting people for, you know, lying to the FBI. Okay, question on the screen. Okay, question. How long do you think the mess in Europe will continue? I have no idea. I think the mess in Europe is going to get a lot worse before it gets better, and we'll see. But if I had to guess, I think that if it gets bad enough, they will, in fact, pull off the stops, and they'll invite the Russians to come across, and there'll be war. And remember, they've got themselves a real nice cold snap. They can always cut off the gas. People will freeze to death, and they'll get the message that way. So the point is this. You know, the trouble with the situation in Europe, people are waking up in part, yes. Do I see a mass in Europe, or for that matter in America, saying, let us return to the God of the Bible? Let's return to the principles of the declaration that we hold certain truths to be self-evident? No. And folks, it will not get better. Read again Isaiah. Read Deuteronomy and what Moshe promised. It won't get better until people start to return. It won't get better until we start realizing that Jesus never did away with the law, and that if we can't recognize who he is and what he really did, to claim that, you know, he saves anything, but we don't know who he is a lie. You cannot have salvation from a fake God. It really is that simple. Gee, Mark, okay, yes. Am I saying what you think I'm saying? I am. I'm saying there's a whole lot of people who are, basing their salvation on another Jesus whom we have not preached. I know this scares folks, and it ought to. Once upon a time, I had a long discussion with my beloved brother. And there's a line that bugged us both. It comes from the writings of Shaul. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Why would Shaul say something like that unless he was well aware that there were fakes? And indeed, Yeshua warned us against them too. Another Jesus whom we've not preached. He's over there. He's here. He's coming. Whoa, don't worry. You'll be beamed up before it gets cold. Nope. We've inherited lies from our fathers. Time to make the big change. And even, again, some of the leftists, you know, that are looking for a political solution, and they don't like the idea of honest elections, obviously, and don't in particular like people that believe in another God other than the God of the Almighty State. As I said, it's a battle to the death. And honestly, I don't think the big battle is between Trump and the never-Trumpers. The big battle is between, and has always been, between those who serve the prince of this world and the swamp critters that enforce his rules, whether they're in Boulder or Hollywood or the District of Criminals or Brussels or London or Paris, and those who walk in obedience to the Creator. And as we pointed out, Isaiah 65 is real clear. Given what's coming, we need to be able to make sure that we are doing our best to walk in obedience to him. And as we saw with Joseph and with Solomon, we need to develop tests and discernment. Yes, we need to prepare ourselves spiritually first and most importantly, physically, for the cold, for the plagues, for all of the other stuff, the economic collapse. I guarantee you, when the dollar collapses, there's going to be a whole lot of people, A, die, and B, hit the streets and start stealing stuff. We need to be prepared in a whole lot of ways. And once we get the big stuff in order, right, food, shelter, clothing, and the spiritual stuff is already hopefully taken care of prior to that, well, then we need to be able to do the testing kind of stuff and have discernment and recognize. Now, the mere fact that somebody comes to me and says, you know, I believe in Jesus, it doesn't prove one thing or another. Because a lot of us have been lied to. Most of us here listening can say, yeah, I was brought up on lies like that. And we have to have discernment. And people get all bent out of shape. They want to go to battle over whether you mispronounce the name or may never even have heard the name and so forth. But ultimately, it really does boil down to who we serve and whether we can recognize the truth when we hear it and see it. Joseph did. Eventually his brothers did. And we'll talk about that next week. But it's very, very important that in the times to come, we are able to have that kind of discernment and that we're able to speak the truth boldly and to prepare a place so that, in fact, there might be life. Now, remember John 10:10, one of my favorite lines. He says, I have come that they might have life. I lay before you this day life and blessing, death and cursing. What the point? What's the point of the Torah made flesh coming? I have come that they might have life and have it more abundantly. If we don't recognize even the basics, folks, we can't get to the point of more abundance, much less to the point that I pray that all of us want to be, which is to hear those words, well done, good and faithful servant. Okay, with that, I'll ask one more time. Any other questions? Anything even that we might have talked about before? I guess now that all of that's in place, if there's some of the things that didn't quite make sense when we talked about the sine waves and the coming solar issues and climate changes, real ones as opposed to the kind that we're being told man is making. Now, that's, by the way, not to say that there isn't man-made climate change, right? I want to be clear on that. Your SUV ain't doing it. But 10,000 military jets with crap in the fuel spraying barium and aluminum nucleation materials out of their ass end may very well have a lot to do with dimming the insolation of the Earth, the amount of sun, in other words, that insolates us. So imagine this, right? At the very time when the solar output is headed down, what are the evil men who serve the prince of this world doing? Making it worse. Not like they haven't got their hidey holes with their nuclear reactors already prepped. And their food set aside. Guess what? They stole it from people via taxes and via printing money, so they'd be all set for it. And they could care less what happens to the peons, the slaves, the disarmed masses, the bitter clingers out there that they always wanted dead anyway. All right, let us close in prayer. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad, Abba, we thank you. We thank you for the chance together. We thank you for your truth. We thank you that you are, in fact, your word. That you are your word made flesh. That you have done all of the things that you said you were going to do up until this point. And that we rest on your promises that you will do those other things that have not yet come to pass, but that will. And we pray that you'd give us discernment and that you'd help us to be where we need to be, doing what we need to be doing, that we'd be counted worthy to escape these things that are coming upon the earth, that we would be found doing your work from here until however long each of us as individuals has. Guide us, protect us, help us to stand on your word, knowing that no weapon formed against us will prosper, and there are plenty of weapons that are intended, but that you are, in fact, our El. You are our King, our Savior, our Redeemer, our Creator. We thank you and praise you, Father. We ask that we would be good and faithful servants unto you. Guide us, help us, give us eyes to see and ears to hear. Heal our houses, heal our families, heal our communities for what lies ahead. Give us strength, Father, to do the things that we need to do. All of this we ask in your set-apart name. For you are our healer, Yahuwah Rapha. You are our banner, Yahuwah Nisi. You are Yahuwah Zedeknu, our righteousness. You are El Shaddai. Hallelujah. Amen. Okay, for those that I see comments on the screen, I'll just make a quick reference to the so-called Noahide covenant. And yeah, there is a covenant with Noah. You can read it in about, it would be in Genesis chapter probably 7 or 8. In the vicinity of the time where Yahuwah says he's not going to destroy the earth with water anymore. And it basically, a lot of what's called the Noahide Covenant emerges from Rabbinic Judaism. And essentially this is where I part company, not with the concept of the things that are outlined specifically, but the claim that, non-Jews, that would be all you goyim, don't have to do the Torah. That's for quote-unquote Jews. Well, wait a minute. No, it's not. Jews are Judah, one tribe, right? Well, wait, that depends on what you mean by Jews, doesn't it? That's why I'm very careful and I use terms like Kol Israel, all of Israel. When we talk about the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, Aholah and Aholabah, Judah and Israel, we have to be careful. Context, time frame. There's a lot of people who don't know who they are. I don't know for sure, what tribes I might have been descended from. I know Abraham's in there, but did I come through Issachar or some others? I don't know. A lot of folks don't know. Even a lot of folks who would say that they're Jewish don't really know, because there are a lot of arguments about, what constitutes that identity. Judah, Benjamin, Levite. Okay, So the point is, those words may or may not mean something. And when somebody tells me, well, you don't have to keep Torah, I'm going to say, A, wrong, and B, I choose to. I choose to. Joel talks about those who'd like to be grafted in. You don't have to know what your bloodline is in order to say, I would like to be saved, grafted in, counted as part of the covenant. And the covenant is clear. I laid before you this day life and blessing, death and cursing, so choose life that you and your descendants might live. Who was Moshe talking to? Kol Israel. Not just Judah, not just Benjamin, not just Levi, not just Ephraim. Exactly. Okay, so the comment from the commentary here. Noah was long before any of that, absolutely. Okay? And certainly we know, too, from reading that Noah had some understanding of the Torah before Moshe wrote it down or had it written down through him. So a whole lot of questions, right? The covenants of Yah don't change. By the way, I didn't mention the specifics of the Noahide covenant, but it's essentially things that were outlined right there in that original, whoever sheds man's blood, his blood, I will require. And don't eat parts off of living animals and so forth. Those are things and that have a good judicial system. So there's a lot of things that are part of the Noahide covenant. I don't argue these are good things. But what I will suggest is that for all of us who would like to be grafted in, who want to be returned, who want to repent of having been sent away in whoring for cause, that we turn from our idolatry and our adultery and we seek to walk in obedience and to do what Moshe said, keep all of his statutes, his judgments, his commandments, and have them written upon our heart and return. And we can and we should. And it's never been more important. Okay. And yes, Israel is bigger. And, I am certainly not a fan of one of the other big lies from the Hort Church about replacement Israel. Dispensationalism and a whole bunch of other crap like that that people have been told. The Jews killed Jesus, and so they got kicked out. And we, who have our own Molechs and Baals and Ishtars and Easters, we know better. So God loves us, in spite of our idolatry, and we are New Israel. Bull. You're still out in exile. And you still have to remember, return, make Teshuvah. Okay, so I hope that at least kind of helps to make some of that distinction clear. I don't have a problem with the Noahide covenant, per se, and the elements that are usually outlined, because you can find those in Scripture. What I do have a problem with is the claim that if you're a so-called Gentile, that you shouldn't be worried about keeping the Torah. The instruction, his instruction, is for all of us. And we got into a whole lot of trouble because we ignored it then, and in so many cases we're still ignoring it, and so much of the whore church is still teaching people they shouldn't try. And in fact, that's one of the biggest lies right out there with the Torah's done away with. Do we believe Europeans came from Northern Israel? Yeah, well, as to specific bloodlines, I'm not going to comment on that. But the Scripture is clear. I already read it this morning. Moshe is clear. We, meaning the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom, Kol Israel, those 12 tribes, have been scattered. Scattered for millennia. All over the whole planet. In every nation, tribe, tongue, people, you name it. He knows where we are. He will regather us, and that we need to help by beginning to return, trying to make ourselves ready, get ourselves cleaned up.